Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
If I'm a slave, call me a slave. Don't tell me that I'm a free person. And I'm still a slave. Yeah, that really lulls me to sleep. You're not really a slave, you know. You're a co-worker. You know, you're a member of the firm, you know. This is the Bodie Plantation, you know. And you are one of our business associates. Now, get that plow moving. Boy, I'm really working out now. I mean, boy, the sweat is flying, whatnot, and I'm behind that mule, and I'm grinning. I'm a business associate at the Bodie Plantation. Man, I feel great. Get up, mule.
So you, as long as the system of white supremacy exists, you don't see
word masters. See what I mean?
The Cows, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of racism. Today's date, Thursday, January 28th, 2016. So I have been told. That was Neely Foote Jr. At the beginning. You can certainly go to his website, producejustice.com, to pick up any of his literature, great information on racism, white supremacy, what it is, how it works. Our broadcast for today, I say all the time, the importance of checking the newspaper. Racism is a local, national, global problem. Folks would really do well, in my view, to spend some time checking out what's in the newspaper. They're talking about racism on a pretty regular basis. There was a report in the Seattle Times. This was right at the end of 2015. Mr. Jerry Large always talk about the importance of black journalists. He wrote a fascinating piece. It's titled, I Felt Sick About It. Seattle woman confronts family's history of slave ownership. Posted the article on my Facebook page. Should be linked in the description for this program. But in it, he's talking to a white woman. She's a professor at the University of Washington, and she's talking about her family's legacy of slave ownership and the importance of being honest about that, how that relates to continuing problems with racism. I thought it would be fascinating to have her as a guest on the program. Reached out and she was willing to speak with us. I think we've had quite a few since I'm in the same area. We've had quite a few guests on the program who are either faculty or students in some way, shape, form affiliated with the University of Washington, or minimum have been residents in the Seattle area, Washington State area. Thought it might even be interesting to see, to kind of go back and look for some of the patterns in terms of what those folks have had to share about the system of racism. At any rate, our guest for today's broadcast, she is a distinguished practitioner and senior lecturer in the Evans School of Public Policy and Governance at the University of Washington. Her list of community service, impeccable. It would take a lot of time to go through everything, but kind of some of the highlights. She's had stints as Assistant State Attorney General, Chair of Washington's Rhodes Scholar Selection Committee, and Treasurer of the Washington State Convention and Trade Center. Really looking forward to getting some of her views, thoughts, talking more about this piece and her ancestors' involvement in the enslavement of black people. Joining us live, our guest, Professor Dorothy Bullitt. Professor Bullitt, are you with us?
I am.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for sharing a bit of your time and energy with us this evening. For folks listening in, this, I'm sure for a lot of people, this is their first time hearing about you. Just anything that you think would be important for folks to know about who you are, the work that you do?
Well, presently I teach leadership at the University of Washington. Perhaps of interest was my high school and junior high school experience was during the late 60s and early 70s, during the Black Revolution in the Seattle area. So I spent those years as a white minority. That may be also of interest.
Absolutely. I think some of that is kind of towards the tail end of the piece that Mr. Large wrote in the Seattle Times. Definitely we will touch on that as well. I think I've already said, I just confirmed for our listening audience, there's a picture of you in the article as well. You are a white woman. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Right on.
And someone just did my DNA, ancestral DNA, and I am 100% European DNA, I learned.
Fascinating. This program
I also found out I was 5% Neanderthal.
How interesting. Okay. This program, The Cows, Context of White Supremacy, I use the term racism and the term white supremacy. I use them as synonyms. I have the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that is an accurate definition?
I'd be more comfortable talking about white privilege than white supremacy. I certainly believe there are people who are white supremacists and who probably subscribe to the view that you just characterized, but I think that that's a much smaller proportion of people than those who are enjoying consciously or unconsciously white privilege.
Okay. I'm just, for our listeners, I think that is hugely important. The very first thing that you said, that you would be more comfortable talking about white privilege, and one of the main tenets of this program, contrary to Macklemore's recent smash release on white privilege, that it's very important, terms being as accurate as possible about terms. And I've concluded that white privilege is not the most accurate term. In fact, I've concluded exactly what you said, that many white people, they are way more comfortable talking about white privilege as opposed to racism, white supremacy, which in my view is way more accurate, because what we're really talking about is a power system, not just I get goodies, I get benefits in a very passive, unconscious, not deliberate manner. So just for me, it would be extremely helpful with that definition. If you don't agree, that's fine. But I ask everyone who comes on the program, just because I think it's very important just to kind of get that established from the beginning.
That's your framework.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
I would say that I grew as an adolescent, I experienced a culture of black supremacy.
Okay, but so, before we get to that, I just want to make sure I get the definition. We're going to talk about your high school experience as well, but I just want to make sure that we have some clarity about that moving forward, so listeners are clear as well on where everybody stands as we have this dialogue. So my definition, I'll give it again, and I just want to, if you could tell us if you think that's accurate, if you think such a system exists. So my definition, every time when I say racism, white supremacy, what I mean is a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Is that accurate?
I do believe that there's a population in the world who does what you describe.
Okay. And do you think globally it would be accurate that white people collectively have more power than non-white people?
I would definitely agree with that.
Okay. Also, just want to highlight the unconscious aspect, because a lot of our listeners, white listeners in particular, submit that white people are unconscious and or that there are a small population of white people that are doing that. I think Dr. Frances Cress-Wells, and she would definitely want me to emphasize that there are not that many white people on the planet. White people are the global minority to begin with. So I think that's also important moving forward. I have been trying to ask as many of the white guests as possible that come on our broadcast. There was an article written in The Atlantic right at the end of 2014, and they were talking about racism, and they had a specific sentence in the article. I'm going to read you the sentence, and just if you could be as honest as possible, that's something that I ask our white guests, as honest as possible, and really make an effort to kind of not beat around the bush and pussyfoot. I know some of these conversations, it can be tough, particularly for white people, to be honest about racism, but really appreciate if you could be as honest with us as you possibly can. The sentence from the article reads, white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism, but rarely are they pained enough. And I just want to ask you, as a white person, you've been around white people, your family, friends, colleagues, and what have you, do you think that sentence is accurate? Do you think that a sizable portion of white people are often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
I would agree.
Okay. Are you often sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
Yes. That's why I agreed to do that interview with Jerry Lurch.
Okay. And how do you demonstrate your sincere and great pain about racism on a daily basis?
Well, a big focus of the way I teach is to incorporate as much diversity within the classroom as possible to get students thinking about implicit bias of all different kinds, and to be very, very conscious about the systems that get in the way of progress. And so in my work, I do it. In my community service, it's an important focus. And in the relationships I cultivate, the places I hello?
Greetings, Professor Bullitt. Our connection just got dropped, lost signal for a second, but we got you back and we're live. So in your response, you said that you include diversity in your classroom. You do teaching lessons about implicit bias. That this is your great pain and sincerity about racism is expressed in where you shop, the community service that you do, and I think we lost you at that point.
And in striving to have diverse relationships, and so I'm conscious in my life trying to wrap in as much diversity, not just black-white diversity, but all different kinds of diversity, into my life, as seeing it as a positive, that it enriches my life, but it also relates to the painful recognition of the systems in place that create such a disadvantage for certain parts of the population versus others that start with a big advantage. So I'm very aware of it. And I've been aware of it since I was a child, a young child I went to Freedom School when I was 10 years old, that my parents sent me to learn about what was happening in the South and with Martin Luther King's efforts in the South, the Jim Crow, the apartheid that existed in America, and trying to get that frame of reference that has been influential in the way I look at our society ever since.
Is it okay for me to ask your age?
I am 60.
Okay. Right on. Just give folks kind of a ballpark of when you were growing up and what have you. Okay. So with your response about that sentence, as I said, I've been trying to ask as many of the white guests that come on the program if they think that sentence is truthful. For a while, the majority of white guests that we had on said that they do not think that that is true. I think the last four consecutive guests have all said that they do think it's true, so it's starting to swing back towards the middle a little bit. Given the fact that at least it seems that we're in agreement that there continues to be a system globally where white people dominate and have more power than non-white people, and that that has not been corrected at this point, do you think it's logical for non-white people to be suspicious, to think that that statement is not true, that white people collectively are not sincerely and greatly pained by racism?
Well, I can understand skepticism, but I do believe that there are many people who are pained. And I think that the past, the second Obama administration has revealed so much blatant racism in the country, and the cell phone videos of the police shootings of African Americans has been so blatant that I would contend that some people who were skeptical before are facing up to this now.
Okay. How did this story, because you, that was, I think, one of the first things you said to evidence your sincere and great pain about racism was the piece that was in the Seattle Times, Mr. Jerry Large. How did that piece come about? Was that something where he contacted you? Did you contact him?
I was at a retirement party for a professor, an African-American history professor, whose professorship was created by my grandmother in the memory of her husband, who loved American history. And he teaches Western American history and African American history. And so I got up to make a little speech about him, and I started it by saying that my grandfather grew up in a plantation. His grandfather was a slave owner. His father was a Confederate soldier, and went on from there talking about the evolution in our family that made this professorship very logical for us, but it also shows the awkward journey of a family that a portion of it was built on slave labor. And so I made this a short little speech to honor the outgoing professor, and Jerry Large happened to be in the audience, came up and asked if I would be willing to be interviewed for an article.
Okay.
And then we met later.
Okay. And what sort of response have you gotten from this piece? It's been about a month since it was published.
I've had a lot of letters and emails from all over the country, and people of different races, black, Asian, and white, and some Hispanic. The my late partner is African-American, and so his whole family got totally into this article, and they spread it around the country, so that's part of it. It's been interesting how many people who contacted me wanted to talk about a secret or a source of shame in their own family's past. So, for example, someone whose grandfather ran an internment camp for the Japanese Americans, or somebody who came from Germany, had German relatives who with Nazi affiliations, or so there were different reactions. And then I had some of my old classmates come out of the blue to respond to the article. So it was quite varied, but what it convinced me, I was very nervous about doing it, and I didn't know what kind of fallout there would be, and I didn't know if my family would be distressed. I was nervous about it, but generally this very encouraging response, and the message of most of the communication was, they want our country to talk about this, talk about the discomfort of the past, and how the past is affecting the present, how the past affects people's opportunities or lack of opportunities. And I was very encouraged by the number of people from all different backgrounds who seemed to feel that was an important thing to tackle.
Hmm. Did you say that your late partner was African-American, a black male?
Yes, that's correct.
Wow, that is fascinating. Fascinating. How long were you all married?
We never married. We were together.
Okay.
Well, and then we were together during the last years of his life in our 50s.
In our 50s.
And I was with his family, his whole extended family last night for his mom's 80th birthday. And I inherited her, so I got a wonderful mother-in-law. I call her my mother-in-law out of it. And she came from South Carolina, from Jim Crow era. And she wouldn't let me in the house when we were teenagers.
So you said she would not want you in the house?
Because I was a white girl.
Wow.
And his one of his sisters was just ferocious towards me in junior high and high school because of being a white girl. And she just was after me all the time. Last night she hugged me. We have become very close and family. We're family. But I witnessed in their family the rage that came out of the Jim Crow South. It was just, and my whole school was just overflowing with that rage because so many of the kids in my school had migrated up from the South with their families. And so that was the context then. And that so much has changed in the intervening decades. We have very, very frank conversations with one another. But we've gone through a long journey, all of us have.
What was the time frame of this partnership, and did you all have offspring?
We did not have any offspring. He did with another woman in between.
Okay.
And he had two kids.
Okay.
And we were teenage partners, and then we were middle-age partners. And he had cancer when we were together.
Okay. Is this the same fellow that's mentioned in the article that you were dating?
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That is fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. His sister contacted me and said that he had carried a torch and would like to see me before he died. And we fell back in love, and he's lived for quite a long time. So we had two very different chapters.
Fascinating, fascinating. Before I get to the high school piece, just kind of walking down, because that's at the end of the article, so some of the things that you all discussed before you get to that. When you're talking about your family, you said that I knew there were slaves, but I got in my head that they had to be nice slave owners because my relatives were nice people. How did you conceptualize, quote unquote, nice slave owners? Like, what would that look like? What would nice slave owners do?
Well, I mainly blocked it out. My parents were both civil rights activists. They were very involved in integrating business and helping with open housing, and they sent me to this inner city school, blah, blah, blah. So I looked at how they connected their life, and I just didn't want to go there. So I knew there were lots of judges and lawyers in my father's family. And I invented things. I just imagined, there probably were hardly any slaves there, and they were probably, you know, gracious to the household, you know. I basically blocked it out. And that's why when I finally made myself watch 12 Years a Slave by myself, and I saw a depiction of it, a very well-educated, cultured slave owner, and I realized, oh my God, that's my family. That cultured, educated, but there was buying and selling human beings and dividing up families, and it just broke like a dam, the realization of the ugliness of it. And then I went online and I started searching to find out how many slaves they really had, and it was over 100 at its largest. And that's when I knew, oh my goodness. I mean, it just made me so sick. So, But as a teenager, because I was dealing with so much black racism, I was being inundated by black racism, so I wasn't feeling a lot of liberal guilt, believe me. And I just wasn't, I just didn't go there.
I made
myself later.
Okay. I just want to parse out the beginning of your response where you said, at one point you said you blocked it out, and then at another point that you said that you had these notions that it wasn't that bad and there weren't that many of them and they were gracious. And in my view, that there is a long tradition. This is where I say a use of words is very important. There is a long tradition dating back to the 19th, 18th century of white people lying. And saying that, hey, this is not that bad. You know, the slaves are having a grand old time. They're treated well. They're well fed. What are you talking about? There's nothing incorrect about this. Do you think it's accurate to say that this is a part of a long tradition of white people practicing white supremacy by belittling the horrors and abuse of enslaving black people?
Well, I think that is surely how some people dealt with it. But I believe that many probably did what I did as a teenager, which was denial, was not wanting to face the ugliness about ancestors in a family where you love the relatives. And any more than a German now, a young German in the democratic country would want to face their ancestors had been participated in the Holocaust. I think it's very similar to the shame and horror that people who came before us could have conducted themselves in that way. The buying and selling people. But I do think that for many people, it will be just denial because it's just too painful to go there, rather than an affirmative an affirmative belief that somehow it was a good institution.
Okay. I want to point out for listeners, because what you said is contradictory, and that's what I mean about sometimes I think, in fact, not sometimes, I think frequently white people are just, they're dishonest when they're talking about this, because you did say that you blocked it out, but you also said that you had created this fantasy notion that they were gracious and kind and there weren't that many of them. And as I said, there's a lot of evidence. I mean, whole books, there's a whole genre of literature around this, Gone with the Wind, these fantasies of well-treated slaves, and in my view, that is a
hang on.
It's not just rubbish. It is an act of racism, in my view, because I didn't really get a yes or no response to that question. I wanted to read this because this Edward Baptist, The Half Has Never Been Told. This is a white man, historian. This book was published in 2014, and it's all about how the enslavement, people like your ancestors, that this is the foundation of American capitalism, this country, the whole economic system of this area of the world. He's just talking about the way that we talk about slavery and it not being accurate. And he says, even white abolitionist critics of slavery and their heirs among the ranks of historians were reluctant to say that it was torture to beat a bound victim with a weapon until the victim bled profusely, did what was wanted, or both. Perhaps one unspoken reason why many have been so reluctant to apply the term torture to slavery is that even though they denied slavery's economic dynamism, they knew that slavery on the cotton frontier made a lot of product. No one was willing, in other words, to admit that they lived in an economy whose bottom gear was torture. Do you think it would be accurate to describe what your ancestors...
The question
was going to be, do you think it would be accurate to describe your ancestors, who had over 100 slaves in Kentucky, as torturers and terrorists? Do you think that's accurate?
Well, I'd want to know more about what those individuals actually did, but I do believe it's true about the institution.
But you're unwilling to apply that label to your ancestors.
I believe that they were involved in an institution that at its root was involved torture and dehumanized population and enjoyed the financial benefits created by slave labor, and broke up families, and did a lot of harm that continues to be felt today. That I would commit to.
Does that?
But I'm not willing to have you. I'm not willing to have you put words into my mouth.
Oh, it's not putting words into your mouth. If you don't agree, that's fine. We're all about just accurate, honest response. If that's your response, no problem. It's not about putting words in anyone's mouth, whatever that means. Fascinating. There are details on this. It's not like we have to be in wonder about what was happening on the family plantation, Oxmoor, down in Kentucky. I think this is your great-grandfather, Thomas W. Bullitt?
Thomas Walker Bullitt was my great-grandfather.
Okay.
That was my grandfather's father.
Got it. He wrote My Life at Oxmoor, Life on a Farm in Kentucky Before the War. This was published in 1911. And he said specifically at the very beginning of the book that this was not written for public consumption, that this was really more written for you, for the Bullitt family, just to kind of know what was happening, what was going on down in Kentucky 19th century prior to the Civil War. So we have some of the details of what was happening on a plantation with over 100 enslaved black people. This is one passage from the book, kind of get your response. Have you read this book? Yes, no?
I've not.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No,
this one passage, it reads, it had become at one time necessary to adopt strict regulations to prevent the Negroes from gathering in crowds at nights and on Sundays. This was due to efforts by the abolitionists secretly to instruct them in the desire for freedom, to dissatisfy them with their condition, to induce them to run away, and to prepare them ultimately for insurrection. Rigid orders were given, pursuant, I suppose, to legislation forbidding Negroes to leave their master's farms without a pass signed by the master. The enforcement of this order, the gentlemen of the neighborhood had not been willing to entrust to any hired official. Consequently, they formed their own. Fascinating segment from Mr. Thomas W. Bullitt. What are your thoughts on that piece from the book?
Well, it certainly makes me glad that my mother's side of the family had abolitionists in them. That's what it makes me think.
Mm-hmm. And does this seems like a blatant contradiction to your notion of kindly slave owners, if they've got these types of regulations?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and that was something I thought at 13 years old.
Mm.
And and then blocking it out. And then when I watched 12 Years a Slave, then I just faced up to it. But it wasn't something that I was dwelling on in the intervening years. And it's consistent with what I ultimately concluded.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Does this seem like terrorism to you? To make sure that people are not meeting in? Okay.
Yeah, it does.
The next passage, the Negro women, especially the mammies who nursed or tended the children of the family, conceived a greater affection for them than for their own children, although they were fond of their own children. The same was true of the maids towards their mistresses, old mistress or young mistress, and of the boys or men who became body servants. We did not have the latter. Thoughts on this passage?
Well, it's embarrassing.
Hmm. Why?
Well, I mean, treating a population as subhuman is what it is. More like pets.
Hmm. Hmm. This seems pretty common, at least to me, this notion that enslaved, tortured, terrorized black people, particularly black females, that they had more care, that they loved the white people that they cared for more than their own black children, black family members. This even comes through in Gone with the Wind. I think this is in The Help, even though that's not set during quote-unquote plantation slavery. Seems to be, at least in my view, another part of this white supremacist mythology. Your thoughts?
Well, I would agree that that's the tone of his writing absolutely is white supremacist.
Okay.
But I find it irritating to have you interrogating me as though I was a slave owner, which is just complete bullshit. I was not living in the middle of the 19th century.
Right, certainly
and
not.
That is a pretty irritating aspect of this conversation.
Okay, I appreciate the honesty. I don't think I've said at any point, I don't think I've called you a slave owner or suggested that you have enslaved any black people. This is your relative. I'm just reading to get your response to what he wrote about your family. You said you
think... Yeah. Okay. Oh, it's embarrassing and it's upsetting it's upsetting.
Okay. And what about it is upsetting? Just because you feel like you're being personally indicted?
No. It's upsetting that someone who was my father's grandfather would have had such a horrible perspective and would be essentially condoning the system that's a terrible system and did so much harm.
Okay.
That's what makes it upsetting.
Okay. Next passage. This is a fascinating book. So if you want to read it, it's free. It's available online because it's so old. You can download a copy of folks if you want a link where you can check it out. Just drop me a message or email or what have you, and I can forward it to you. It's not that long, so it shouldn't even, take you a long time to read. Next passage. The other fact is this. So far as I am aware, no mulatto child or children were born at Oxmoor. I believe my father to have been absolutely faithful to his marital vows. Besides, illicit connection with a negress would have repelled him as a degradation and a dishonor to himself and family. He would have resented in the most resolute way any interference with the Negro woman by white men, his own sons especially. It has been the fashion to reproach Southern farms and Southern society on this ground, doubtless with too much truth. But it is my conviction that in this respect, Oxmoor was free from the stain of criminality. Your thoughts on this passage?
Well, I hope there was no rape of slaves. I hope that it's true that there was no rape. But also embedded in that conversation is a lot of implicit racism.
Like what specifically?
Well, pervaded it. I think about my African American niece and my African American nieces and great nieces and nephews in my family now, and just thinking how they would feel in reading this and knowing that's part of their ancestry and how complicated that is.
Do you did I hear correctly where you said that you hope? Do you have any reason to suspect that he might not have been being truthful in this passage?
No, I don't. I can't speak for his honesty. I did not know him, but I hope that none of my relatives raped slaves. I very much hope that is true, but I also strongly suspect that even if they didn't. Even if my particular ancestors did not rape anybody, that there were enough slaves on that plantation to have overseers and a layer of supervision that I wince to think what did happen. I suspect that that there was rape on that plantation. I hope that it didn't happen. I hope my relatives were not involved, but they were implicitly involved, even if they didn't act, if they employed people who did.
Number one, that there is a section in the book where he talks about there was obviously that many enslaved black people. They did have overseers on the plantation, and he gives some of the details about how all that was set up and everything. So that's one. Two, just for folks who have been keeping up with the book study session, The Half Has Never Been Told, that's exactly where we left off at last week. The ritual rape of black people during slavery, where he talks about how common this was, that this was even one of the things that motivated the practice of enslaving black people, to have just a free-for-all where you can sexually terrorize these people at will. You could do so publicly, that this was just an endemic part of the enslavement system. And this really worldwide, I was going to say this area of the world, but worldwide, this was just part and parcel. This goes along with the territory. Just on that basis alone, I strongly suspect that we're not getting honesty in this portion of the book here. Just the fact that there were so many enslaved black people at Oxmoor, it reminded me of another book, and the author is going to be coming on the program in a couple weeks, Ned Sublett. He's a white man. The book was just published at the end of 2015, The American Slave Coast, where he says every, and he has this in italics in the book, every farm where the enslaved had children was a slave breeding farm, if only because every newborn slave child increased an estate's net worth. And one of the main points that they have in the book, whether this comes out in forced rape, where you're getting black males, you're forcing them to rape other black females on the plantation so that you have more slaves, you can sell them off or do make them work, whatever you want to do, whether you personally as a white enslaver are going out and doing this yourself, that this, again, this is just a rampant aspect of what slavery is. Is that, do you think, just what do you think about that label? Your family's plantation had over 100 slaves, so it would qualify by his definition as a slave breeding plantation. Is that something that you think about? Is that the way that you present when you talk about what happened there?
I don't know. I do know when I was in an adolescent that a lot of the culture of my school tied back to these issues. So, for example, black males might have white girlfriends. Like when my boyfriend and I would go out, he was fine being with me. But if he saw a white man with a black woman, he would go ballistic. He changed over the decades. He became much more focused on individuals. But that pain of the of Jim Crow and of slavery and of the abuse of black women by white men, both slave owners and others, was very, it was pervasive in my adolescent culture. I was aware of it all the time.
Hmm. Is the Oxmoor property in Kentucky, is that still in the Bullitt family?
I'm not positive. I've never been to Kentucky. Oh. A friend of mine who wrote a book about his great-grandfather, who was a slave and an abolitionist, he ended up speaking at a Kentucky Historical Society at Oxmoor. So it has a public function there. So there's a lot of it is. I don't know if there's anybody who actually lives there anymore, or if it's just a public building. I don't know.
Okay. Was this, do you recall, like, growing up and what have you, this particular book that I'm reading from, My Life at Oxmoor, Life on a Farm in Kentucky Before the War, was this, like, in your household and you just didn't read it? I know you said you didn't read it, but are you aware if it was, like, actually in your residence at any time?
I can't speak to that. I don't know.
Okay. Do you know the derivation for the name of this plantation, Oxmoor, like, why it was called that, where that name came from?
No. Mm-mm. I don't.
Okay. Was any of this talked about amongst your parents or other family members? Was this, you know, anything that you heard, any dialogue about while you were growing up?
Well, I remember when some of my siblings would go to different cities and they would call people with our last name in the phone book and how often they would encounter African Americans. And so they started realizing, wow, this is a powerful discovery. So that's one thing that was discussed as my siblings became older. My father would sometimes talk about his grandfather being a Confederate soldier, and then I believe that a brother, his grandfather's brother, was a Union soldier because they were right on the border of the Confederacy and the Union. So there was some talk about that, but there was talk about the judges in the family or the history of lawyers or in, but it was not. There was not a, even though my dad was really involved in civil rights and did a lot to try to integrate broadcasting and open housing and et cetera, he did not talk directly about the slave owning aspect of the family, at least not to, in my presence.
That bit that you shared kind of at the beginning of your response about the number of times when you all look in the phone book or wherever and you see the last name Bullitt, the number of times that it ended up being a black person, an African-American, as you said.
Right.
That, to me, would strongly suggest there was probably some rape happening on the plantation. I know it was common for enslaved black people to take the name of their white enslaver, but that might, to me, strongly suggest that there was some rape going on.
And we discussed that with my siblings, and I discussed it when wondering if that had been true, wondering if family members had been involved, if employees of the family had been involved, or if they had simply taken the name. It was quite awkward, that the encounters.
Fascinating. Tenth generation attorney, professor at the University of Washington, Dorothy Bullitt. I'm just trying to get the name straight. Alexander Scott Bullitt. Is this your grandfather or?
That was my father's father. Yeah, my paternal grandfather.
Paternal grandfather. Okay, so he's a part of the group that has migrated away from Kentucky, come up here to Washington State, King County. At least what I read online, he was a part of helping to promote the Democratic Party in this area of the world. This is like early 20th century, early 1900s. Just as I read that, I thought, wow, like the Democratic Party at that time is not like what people think of now. Bernie Sanders, President Barack Obama, the Democratic Party would have been like the party of Donald Trump at that time. You had Wilson.
He didn't come up until 1918, and then they went back to Kentucky briefly. Came back around 1920. So it was in the 1920s that he was helping to develop the Democratic Party here. He ran for governor. He ran for senator. It failed both, but he was instrumental in getting it going. He was a mentor to a man, Warren Magnuson, who became an influential Democratic senator in the Senate. And he was friends with Franklin Roosevelt. And he was scheduled to introduce Franklin Roosevelt at the 1932 Democratic Convention. But he died of a very fast-moving cancer and was unable to do that. But his Democratic philosophy was consistent with Franklin Roosevelt's philosophy.
Okay.
Though who knows what it was at the beginning of the century. It was undoubtedly more conservative then. But by the time that my father and his sisters were involved in the picture, his father was progressive.
Okay. Despite that, at that time, as I said, early 20th century, talking early 1900s, the Democratic Party would be more closely in line with what people would today associate with Donald Trump and blatant racism. This would be people like Woodrow Wilson, Ben Tillman down in South Carolina that we've talked about consistently. That did not flip until the Civil Rights Movement, where white people who were more explicit and blatant about racism, white supremacy, switched and said, we're done with the Democratic Party. But that, and Ben Tillman did come to Washington State during this time frame, early 20th century, 1900s, to talk about racism, white supremacy, and the trouble with Negroes, even though you didn't have tons of black people in Washington State at that time. That just stood out to me. A little bit of history, very important to know that. The Oxmoor Farm is estimated to be worth over $73 million. Has any money from the Bullitt Trust been used to compensate any, if not all, the descendants of the more than 100 slaves whose free labor generated the Bullitt wealth?
Well, no money. It was, my grandfather didn't bring much money of any kind. Mm. He was a lawyer, and that's how he earned his living, and then he worked for my grandmother's father. So there was no, it was more education. It was that, I think that there was not wealth that at least passed to our part of the family from there, and that he was not a wealthy man. But he was an educated man, and his siblings were, and the men in that family had been educated for many generations. So that was a product, clearly, of the education itself flowed from the financial stability that did exist from slave labor. Slave labor was there, I believe, from the late 1780 until the emancipation of the slaves on that plantation in the late 1850s. For some reason, there was an emancipation before the Civil War. I don't know why.
Hmm. Okay. Do you think reparations or financial amends should be made to non-white black people in the United States now or in the foreseeable future?
I think that public policy should recognize the inequality in our country and the disadvantage that certain people have, and that the structural advantage that anyone who's white, even an immigrant, has in this country. So I'm a supporter of affirmative action. I'm in favor of investing in infrastructure, investing in schools, investing in affordable housing, and to help lift people up and have a more equitable country. So that's the way in which I believe that it's appropriate and would support the policies. I also think it's important as a country to talk frankly about the different advantages that different groups of the country have, just starting off, and that that incidence of poverty over many generations can be so disabling to somebody to really make it. So people don't have an equal start, and I do believe that.
Hmm. Okay. Number one, I'm obligated. Anytime affirmative action is brought up, it is undisputed. The evidence clearly shows that the people who benefited most from affirmative action are people like you, white women, and that should never be contested. This is not controversial. This is in Time magazine. There have been many studies on this. It is no contest. It is not black people. It is white women who have been who have benefited most from affirmative action. But that notwithstanding, I'm not sure that I got a clear answer to the question, so I'll just ask again. Do you think reparations or financial amends should be made to non-white black people in the United States today or in the foreseeable future? Again, you know, whatever your response is, that's fine, but I didn't get a clear answer.
I don't believe in handing out cash. I do believe in public policy that helps to remedy it through investment, educational opportunity, housing, construction, infrastructure, transportation support that can help lift up disadvantaged populations and to recognize, to do a little leveling in that way at a public policy level.
Would you support public policy if it was not, as you say, handing out cash, but housing, education, healthcare, but it was specifically to target black people and specifically tied to this is to repair the damage that white people have done to black people as a result of racism, white supremacy in all its forms throughout the last 3, 4, 5 centuries in this area of the world?
I think that if something was framed that way, it would tear the country apart. And if it was with the language you just used, I think Native Americans would come forward and say, hello, what about us?
Okay, so if we include all non-white people, would you support it? And same language, just including non-white people.
I think that the language you use would be so inflammatory as to be explosive. So I don't want to start a revolution.
Why would that be inflammatory? Is anything that I said inaccurate? Was it anything inaccurate that I said? Is anything not true?
I just think the tone, I'm a realist about how politics works. And I'd like to see higher tax rates. I'd like to see more public investment, more opportunity to lift people up through education, housing, good transportation, safe cities, and give more people an opportunity to have a chance to succeed. And I think that we've had a lot of Americans had an opportunity to enter the middle class in the 50s and early 60s, but they tended to be white people because there were restrictions in public housing, for example.
That's
so
racism.
A lot of the, it was racism. And so it wasn't equal. The investment, public investment that gave an advantage to many poor people, that was good, but it excluded black people by and large during those years. And so I'd like to see something that is much more consciously equitable.
Okay. Just for me, is it possible, yes, no, if it was something that was...
No,
steady?
I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do a yes, no, because I don't like the language you use in characterizing. Once again, I don't want you to put your words in my mouth.
Okay. It's not, again, not putting words in your mouth if you don't agree. That's fine. That's just, in my view, that's a part of just having honest dialogue. If I don't agree with the way something is stated, I just say that. I don't agree. It would be no. I don't agree with the way it's phrased. Maybe if it was phrased this
way. I don't agree with the way it's phrased, but I do believe that as a country, we have an obligation, and it is in our self-interest to create more equity through public investment.
Okay. Who would revolt, incidentally? And before I move forward, I would like a yes or no on this one. Is it accurate what I said in terms of these deliberate acts against black people in terms of why they would need this assistance, or not even assistance, these repairs would be needed? Is it accurate? Not, you know, the reparations part, but just is that accurate in terms of what white people have done in this area of the world?
Oh, I think there's no question.
Okay.
That it's accurate.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who, incidentally...
No, I thought we were going to conclude at 6. Is that correct?
I have a few more questions. Is it possible that you can hang out so I can finish?
Okay.
Great.
Okay.
Great, great, okay. Great. Mm-hmm. Who would... Because you said that you're a realist and people would revolt if it was phrased that way. Who would be revolting and why, in your opinion?
I think lots of Americans would.
Like who?
Lots of immigrants would. I think that it would be hard to find political allies to, I guess that I would much rather have someone who is pushing for equity, public investment that ends up benefiting people who have been disadvantaged rather than being righteous in tone and condemning in tone. Because I think you get someone who emigrated here from Canada who says, I didn't do anything. Why should I be involved in that? Why should there be public investment? I think what we have a conversation about the benefits that flow almost unconsciously to people who are white is built into the structure of the country. So there are built-in advantages. And so to create more equity is important, but not poking people in the eye who don't feel at all like it had anything to do with them. And there are many, many Americans who don't think it has anything to do with them. So I would like to see a strategy that would actually produce major public investment and a much more equitable distribution of wealth in the country. But to do so in a way that brought along the vast majority of Americans rather than cause people to dig in their heels.
Okay. Fascinating metaphor for our listeners, poking people in the eye. Did you say to do so in a way that's not racist? I just want to make sure I heard you correctly. Is that what you said?
No.
Oh, okay. What did you say?
I'm getting pretty tired. I worked all day long. I don't know what you're referring to.
Okay, I know you said anxious, but I thought that you also said to do so in a way that does not make people anxious to do so in a way. But you said you did not say. Okay.
I don't recall saying that.
Okay.
So I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay. Well, I can go back and listen again. I just wanted to clarify that. Do you support reparations for victims of the Nazi Holocaust or Japanese internment? Do you support that?
No, I mean I'm not educated about these. I think all three were terrible, but I don't want to make an uninformed decision talking on radio when I haven't done my research. I just see it as being complicating. For any kind of just handing over bills. I'm in favor of public policy that make us a more equitable country and invest in housing, education, transportation, opportunity that is widespread and not restricted to a privileged portion of the population. That's what I believe in. But I don't want to get into details about reparations because I've not spent time preparing, thinking about it. I thought I was just going to talk about the article. I didn't realize it's going to be a vehicle for you to pontificate.
We're just having honest dialogue about racism. I thought, you know, that was something that you thought. Just to get in my last few questions here, I did also want to say, because you did say unconscious, and that's something that I offer major pushback to anyone who comes on this program and says that there are centuries, not years, not decades, centuries of explicit, bold-faced white supremacist policies, where it's in deeds, even in Seattle. There have been reports that recently were published at KUOW talking about things that happened not in the 19th century or the 1700s, things that happened within the last 50, 60 years, where there are restrictive deeds, where it says you cannot have Negroes in this area, you cannot have non-white people. I offer that pushback every time, because in my view, that is a major gargantuan act of racism, white supremacy, when white people submit that this has been done unconsciously or unknowingly, or somehow white people are not aware of this, that is simply inaccurate, and the evidence is overwhelming to support that. I just wanted to get that in as a statement.
And I would respond to that by saying, when I was a child, my mother would take me and my younger brother out around our neighborhood with a black man who was going to work for my father at a broadcasting company in an executive position right after open housing was passed, and she would go to landlord after landlord trying to help him find housing, and she always would say, if you're going to turn him down, you have to do it in front of these two children. So I was very aware of that shift in our city, that the law changed before the culture changed. And so I completely agree that that existed.
Right on. You, as I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, you did a stint as assistant state attorney general during that time. At any point, how did your own biases as a white woman influence the way that you prosecuted or handled any cases that you dealt with?
Well, it was a workers' compensation. I defended the Department of Labor and Industry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was, I just was representing the state, and it wasn't a there was no prosecution involved. It was, I did draft a bill, crime victim compensation legislation for the state that was passed, and by chance, my late partner's younger brother was murdered, and because of that legislation, his family was able to bury him, and that covered the cost of it. But anyway, that had nothing to do with bias either. It just incident that just happened to be the kind of work that I did. I never did any prosecution.
Okay. Do you think any of your biases as a white woman, conscious or unconscious, impacted the way you dealt with cases involving worker compensation for black males or black females or non-white people in general?
I was defending the state against claims, and I don't believe that there was any difference in the way I would handle the defense in one case versus another.
Okay.
It was relating to medical issues. It just, yeah, you're not going to get anywhere on that line of questioning.
I definitely wanted to bring up the boyfriend issue because you brought that up at the very beginning. I guess the first point before I get to this black supremacy that you experienced, you said that when you were dating this black male in high school, Garfield High School, is that where you were?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, when you all were dating, that you saw the limits that were imposed on his family by racism, white people. Like, what, can you give us the details? Like, what were you seeing specifically?
Actually, a lot of that I learned later in my 50s when we were together again. And what I was referring to is having grown up his early life in the Jim Crow South. So colored-only water fountains, restricted bathrooms. And then when they came west and lived in public housing and dealing with some discrimination when he was little, there was some racism that they experienced in Seattle as well as in South Carolina.
Oh, like what were they experiencing in Seattle? Because people normally think of here as being super, super liberal and not racist. What were they experiencing?
In the 50s, when they got here, Patrick, as a little boy, felt that he was encountering racism on the part of a principal in particular in one town where they lived, not in Seattle. It was a Navy town in Washington. And then when he was in the 10th, in the 5th grade, he went into a primarily white school, and he was treated fine, but he felt very uncomfortable being so, you know, there were so few black kids in the school. But when he was copper-colored skin, so he felt very black when he was in the largely white school. But when he got to Meany, our junior high, he faced a lot of prejudice for not being black enough looking. He had siblings who were darker, but he was more copper, and that was hard for him too. He felt like he fell into a gap, and so he became very militant for a period of time. Very aggressive, very militant, beating up white kids, and that was. And then he just kind of went on a journey. He ended up being a very loving, very, he just got human beings, just enormous emotional intelligence. But he went through that long journey to get to that point.
Was this quote unquote militant phase? Was this while you all were dating in high school, or was this afterwards?
No, he would be more militant before.
Okay.
In junior high. And by the time we were together, he was just, We dealt with a lot of racism, black girls who were very hostile to us for dating, but he kind of gone through that super militant phase already. He wasn't as much, that wasn't an issue other than his aversion to any white man being with a black woman, which was very unusual at that time, but that was a aspect of his childhood and the perspective that he brought from the South.
Okay. Now, definitely. Now I want to get the details because you were talking about this earlier. So you said that you dealt with quote unquote black supremacy while you were in high school at Garfield High School,
and junior high.
Were dating junior high while you were dating this black male, and you just shit particularly it seems black females. I'm just pointing this out for listeners that at the very beginning of the conversation you said that you were more comfortable with white privilege when I used the term white supremacy, but it seems like there was no discomfort in using the term black supremacy.
In the culture of my junior high and high school, was black supremacy.
What does that mean
that
exactly?
Beauty was entirely black beauty. I knew I could, the whole time I was adolescent, I couldn't imagine being ever considered beautiful because I didn't have an afro. I didn't have beautiful black skin. So my whole notion of beauty was that I was called white bitch every single day, many, many times a day. I was assaulted. I was sexually attacked because of being white. Boys would wait in the hall. All the bathrooms got slashed that said boys. They were all changed to men. So it was just the culture was very much a furious reaction to Jim Crow, to the racism in particularly in the South that had been imported up here by so many migrants, but also the city itself. I mean, there was still great inequality in Seattle. The moms all were doing domestic work. There was very little opportunity to have profession. There was some that was changing then, but it was just a very angry time. There was a very Stokely Carmichael had a huge impact in that environment. The day after Martin Luther King was killed, I was attacked by 40 people accusing me of having killed him. So that's another example. It was intense.
Wow, you were attacked by, these were 40 black people here in Seattle at Garfield at the time?
Yeah, when I was 12 years old at Meany Junior High.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
I stood up on a rail and I talked about what Martin Luther King had meant to me and the values that he embodied and the values that I strive to embody, and they went away.
Wow. That is amazing. That is amazing in so many respects. My only response, I can quote Mr. Edward Williams Jr. at counter-racism.com, where he says that just the very definition, words, the very definition that you cannot have two supremes, just from your own testimony, you saying that the rampant racism, white supremacy that black people were experiencing in Seattle at this time, the children and parents of the children, family members of the children that you were going to school with, that they were working as domestics, the help for white people, having difficulties we already talked about, getting housing, employment. We've already talked about on this program being relegated to the Central District and even where you can get a residence at and what have you. It seems like white people were dominating and terrorizing, abusing black people in the Seattle area. That, to me, is white supremacy.
Oh, I'm sure they absolutely were. But I was saying that what I was experiencing as a kid, as an 11-year-old, 12-year-old, 13-year-old, I was in a black world. That's where I was experiencing it.
Mm.
When you talked earlier about white supremacy, it was a very general term that was wrapping everybody in it.
I think I gave a very specific definition for what I meant by white supremacy, which I can repeat now, but I just want our listeners, our program is about logic, accuracy with words, really paying attention to things that people say to make sure that it makes sense. Is it accurate? Is it truthful? And I would just submit from what you gave us, if black supremacy is for a period of time while you were a child, you were called names. There was graffiti on the walls. You said that you were attacked at different points. It seems a lot of this was verbal.
A lot of physical attacks as well. Yeah. A lot of racism and a lot of sexual attacks. Yep.
A lot of sex. What does that mean exactly? Give us some.
My breast grabbed, my crotch grabbed, two men trying to rape me in a bathroom in my high school.
Mm-hmm. Did you contact anyone? Did you tell your parents about this or school administrators so that they could?
The school administrators were so impotent at that time. Those of us kids who chose to stay in the school and not bus out, we just kept our mouths shut. I told my parents later.
Okay.
But I just dealt with it. We just dealt with it ourselves.
Okay. I'm just going by what was in the article that Jerry Large wrote. From what he said there, you could have went to private school at this time.
I could have. And a lot of kids bussed out to other schools.
Okay.
I stayed on principal because I thought that if the school became totally segregated, that it would just be forgotten. By the city. And
what
I felt it was important.
What would be forgotten specifically?
I was a teenager thinking, but we had this notion, the few white kids that were there, was that we believed in integrated education, and we believed if we just would hang in there that gradually the school would reintegrate and that it would just that it would be a better school for everyone. And so many of the wealthier black kids bust out, all the Asian kids ultimately bust out. It was mainly very poor people and almost completely black when I was there. And the school deteriorated terrible. The quality of the teaching, the quality of the resources, and it was only when it got reintegrated that there was a lot of public investment in the school and much better teachers and much better opportunities. So it was just the notion somehow while we were there that it was important to stay. Hmm. And it was my school. It was also my neighborhood school. So I also wanted to be there for that reason.
Okay. I just would submit, in my view, that sort of comparison where you're describing what you went through voluntarily, it seems to me, as black supremacy in an environment dominated by white supremacy. I just view that as another act of racism. You could have, by your own testimony, you could have opted out at any point. You could have went to a private school, took the option that many other people took. And it seems that this concluded in a relatively short period of time, that you moved on and did other things where you were not in this quote-unquote world of black supremacy. That is totally not an option for any of these non-white people. And in fact, I would use the term that you said. I think that's most accurate to describe what you talked about, black people responding to racism, white supremacy, and being terrorized in all areas of people activity.
Yeah,
to me,
I think that point is a fair point that you're making.
I tell listeners to watch that word fair. You also said that you talked about it as well, that you have a niece who I guess has one white parent and one black parent. Does she know about the history of your family and them peddling?
Yeah, she does.
Oh, wow. Have you had any conversations to kind of get her thoughts about this?
Yeah, we corresponded a lot before I agreed to do the. Once I had agreed to do the article, I wanted her to be part of the conversation going into it, and I wanted her to make sure she'd be comfortable with me doing it and alluding to her in the interview. And she's game.
Has she ever talked about experiencing any racism from either other family members or other white people here in Washington State?
Well, she grew up in North Carolina, most of it, and
oh, okay.
She was here for a while. She experiences she's a beautiful black woman, and so as she experiences when walks in a room, she's perceived as a black woman. She's had many privileges, and she has an excellent education and very articulate. So she feels like she is privileged. She's very aware of her privilege. But she absolutely does deal with it in various situations, no question.
When you say she's privileged, what is that referring to specifically?
Well, she went to NYU, and she's at the Sorbonne, and she went to Trinity Dublin University in Ireland. She's very well educated. She's going to go to law school next year. She's beautiful. She's articulate, she's funny and wise, and she's worked in countries around the world. She wants to be an international human rights lawyer. She grew up with a mother who's a painter and a father, her adopted father, who is a poet and a professor, English professor. So she had that, a lot of privilege, and she's very aware of that.
Being a member of the...
But she's still a black man. Still a black woman.
Being a member of the Bullitt family, I'd put that on the list too. Are black people racist? Is it possible for black people or non-white people to be racist against white people?
Yes.
Okay. How so?
Absolutely. Yeah.
How so?
Well, I've just spent a big chunk of my life being the object of racism, so I know it when I see it.
A big wow. So yes, have there been periods that extended beyond what you told us in junior high where you felt black people were being racist against you or any non-white people being racist against you?
In high school. So in 5 years. 5 years, I experienced it daily, and it was unequivocally racism, correct? It was very overt racism. There are other kinds of subtle racism, but I experienced overt racism during that time. And yes, it was black on white racism.
Black on white. Okay. You just said a big chunk of your life, and you said this 5-year period of school when you were in high school, junior high, just doing the math, that would be less than 10% of your life where you experienced,
yeah,
quote-unquote, black
as
racism.
As a 6-year-old, but think about your own childhood. Think
mm-hmm.
about your own adolescence.
Mm-hmm.
That is formative. Who, what you go through during those years can have a big impact.
Mm.
So it had a big impact, and it's something that I never forgot. And the experience I never forgot, and it has had a lot of positive impacts on me. I think it's why I try to really get students thinking about bias, implicit bias, and overt bias, of course, all different kinds. I think it's just very important to consider.
Fascinating. I just remind listeners again that according to her own testimony, Professor Bullitt could have opted out of that school experience at any time if she so chose. That is not an option that victims of white supremacy had. At least I have never had that option of opting out of a world dominating by white supremacy. Who do you think is more confused about white supremacy racism, white people or non-white people? When I say confused in terms of the mechanics, how white supremacy operates, the details, who do you think is more confused, white people or non-white people?
White people.
White people. And why is that?
Because you told me we were going to talk for 15 minutes.
I know.
Now,
I know.
Almost an hour and a half. So I'm really going to have to wrap up here.
Can you give us 5 minutes?
I have more work to do.
Can you give us 5 minutes? I said, can you give us 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 5 minutes.
Why do you think white people are more confused?
I think that when someone is in a position of dominant power mm. and privilege, that it's easier not to realize that they're getting benefits. I think that it's like the favored child in the family may not think that they're favored because they don't have the perception that someone who is not favored has. So I just think it's a byproduct of privilege.
Fascinating. You were the chair of the Cecil Rhodes Scholarship Committee, Selection Committee, for a period of time. Is that accurate?
4 or 5 years, yes.
5 years, okay.
For Washington State.
For Washington State. I'm sure you have some knowledge of Cecil Rhodes and his conduct on the continent of Africa.
Yeah.
And even, I think, the last year has been dominated, particularly in South Africa, these campaigns, Rhodes Must Fall, and saying that this guy perpetuated white supremacy and his statues need to come down and his whole legacy is about terrorizing and abusing black people. What would your response be to people who say that this scholarship is just another facet of white supremacy and promoting his racist legacy?
Well, I think he was a racist, and I think he did a lot of harm, but I believe that the Rhodes Scholarship was a great gift, and it has benefited people of all different colors, people who come from the English-speaking world. And among the students who we interviewed and considered for the to move on, we didn't make the ultimate choice. We sent people on to the region. There were people of all different races, including African American, who benefited from it, and those who made it to Oxford had marvelous education, and it's a very diverse university. So I agree he was a racist, and I think that the opportunity provided by the scholarship has benefited people of all races and both genders. It used to be only men and only white men, and that was, I'm not sure when that changed, but when I was involved, it was that had all been stripped away.
Hmm. I know. I've seen the wall. It's at the University of Washington. I forget the specific building, but they have a wall with all of the University of Washington students who have won a Rhodes Scholarship, and it is heavy with white people, white males specifically, but I mean, it is way, way disproportionately white folks who have gotten that scholarship. And I think what I saw at the University of Washington is pretty representative globally in terms of who have gotten benefited from these Rhodes Scholarships since they've been giving them out. Do you disagree?
Well, I mean, if you're looking all the way back to the 1900s, absolutely, it would be white dominant, white male dominated, because it was only in the more recent past that it had been opened up to women and to people of color. but it's certainly diverse from the experience I had with it. But I was just a little piece of the process.
Okay. 2 minutes. I think I can get in quick two questions. Can you share with us any ways that you can honestly acknowledge that you have practiced white supremacy racism against any non-white people in your 60 years on the planet?
I'm sure that there are places when I've done it inadvertently, but I don't. Yeah, I'm sure that there have been.
You can't think of one of those moments where it's
not an incident, no.
Fascinating. Wow. Have you ever been accused? Has a non-white person ever accused you of doing something that they thought was racist?
No.
Fascinating. Okay. What would your response be? There are authors and many folks who study racism, white supremacy, who submit that as long as the power dynamic of white supremacy exists, that it is incorrect for white people to engage in any sort of sexual relationship or quote-unquote dating of any non-white person as long as the system is in place, because white people have more power than the non-white person, that relationship is inherently exploitative, where the non-white person is being taken advantage of, that it's pretty much the same dynamic as we had on the plantation. What is your response to that?
I think that's overbroad and not accurate in my experience.
What's inaccurate?
I'm exhausted, and I really don't want to get into this conversation. It sounds ridiculous what you just said, so I don't want to go into a long conversation. I want to stop and go back and get my work done, because I've talked to you for an hour and a half.
Wow.
And I did it as a favor, and, you know, I don't have the energy to keep going.
That is, I appreciate the honesty. That I will savor those last words. I don't have the energy to keep going. Right on. This is Professor Dorothy Bullitt, University of Washington professor, ancestors, enslavers of black people, peddlers of flesh. Fascinating dialogue. I will review. I hope listeners really paid attention and got some constructive information from Professor Bullitt. Thank you for sharing a bit of your Thursday evening. I learned a lot. It has been fascinating. Wow. If you do any future writing about racism or videos, anything like that, if you do any talks here in Seattle, I would love to come check it out. If you do any talks, if you could, can I make that request as you exit? If you do any talks or anything here in Seattle, or just Washington area, period, if it's in Western Washington, could you just drop me an email? Because I would love to come check it out and maybe ask a question or two.
I will agree to that.
Okay. Beautiful. 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 I would love to come check out. Thank you. Thank you. And enjoy the rest of your evening, Professor Bullitt.
Thanks. Bye.
For sure. Context of white supremacy. Wow. Fascinating. Fascinating exchange. For listeners, I think I said, I said it explicitly yesterday that Professor Bullitt said she would be agreeable to coming on the program, but she did not want to take any live questions. This was, I think, one of the first. I had to go back and dig in my emails to be, you know, totally exact, accurate about it. But I think the exchange went when I initially sent her the interview request. I think when she wrote me back, she said, is it live? And do you all take live questions? And then I wrote her back and I said, yes, we are live. And we do take live questions. And she wrote back and she said that she wouldn't be comfortable. I don't remember the exact phrasing, so I'm paraphrasing here. But I think the phrasing was something to the effect of she wouldn't be comfortable just taking live questions from random folks. Is it possible to do the interview without taking questions? I think that's the statement. If you really want to hold me to the fire, I can go back and look at the emails to see exactly what she said in the exact sequence. But I'm pretty sure that that was it. And then she asked if she could hear a program. And I think I said previously on the program that I did send her a broadcast. I did not send the whole broadcast. I sent like a 5-minute snippet when Jim Grimsley, admitted racist, was on the program. He was talking about growing up in North Carolina. Also, his experience, I think they're about the same age group, his experience when schools were, quote unquote, integrated in North Carolina. And he also talked about slavery and how he, I guess, learned about it, how it was talked about around his racist family members and the racist white people in his section of North Carolina. I sent her like a 5-minute segment on that. She listened to it and said that she liked my interview style and she would be down to come on the program and chat it up. This was like weeks ago. It took a while to get the scheduling and everything, but I think that is the sequence. But she had said in advance that she didn't want to take any questions from live callers. That's why I told people yesterday to email your questions and I would try and weave them in. I did nab quite a few of the folks who did questions right on for the folks who submitted their questions. One of our listeners in particular, he found the book that I've read from, which is a hoot, man. I definitely would have had more time to get questions in if I had not read some of the segments from the book, but it was astounding. I had more sections of the book highlighted. I just, you know, tried to pick out the stuff that I thought was the juiciest tidbits from the book. But again, I have this. If you want, it's free. The book was published in 1911, so generally the copyrights, you know, start to fall away after a certain amount of time, so you can, you know, get it yourself. You can download it for free. It's My Life at Oxmoor, Life on a Farm in Kentucky Before the War. So I think she said this is her great, great grandfather, if I'm remembering correctly, Thomas W. Bullitt, My Life at Oxmoor. It is fascinating to get the details if you want to do a little extra research and go back and search. Fascinating exchange. I can only say I am super glad. There have only been a few times in the years that we've been on the program where I have been willing to accommodate a white person coming on the program where they said that they didn't want to take any questions. Jane Elliott is another one, white woman, also an admitted racist, white supremacist, but that's another incident where I accommodated and said that I wouldn't take any questions, even though when she did get on the program, we did take a handful of questions the first time that she was a guest on the program. But I am so glad that I did. That is a fascinating session. Man, oh man, I will get folks if you would like to share and give any commentary. I can only say, I again want to give my thanks to Mr. Jerry Large. I am going to send this interview to him so he can check it out and peruse. And maybe if he's interested in coming on the program, definitely major appreciation for black journalists, the importance of black journalists. If you check out, if you go to Seattle Times and put in Jerry Large, I think his columns will pop up because he talks a lot about racism. Most of it is, you know, Seattle related, of course, but not always, but most of it. But it, you know, it might be interesting if you want to go back and check out. But huge thanks to Jerry Large, because I would have not even known about Dorothy Bullitt if he hadn't written the piece. It's the whole reason for this program, to ask questions of racist suspects. When the cows started out, I was not seeing white people be questioned in a serious manner. It would be talking to this white person and just elated that I'm in the presence of some melanin deficient individual, and this person is so cool. This person certainly is not a racist, certainly not an enemy of black people, non-white people. That is the predictable tone that these type of conversations happen. That's why individuals like Professor Bullitt can be so comfortable and saying, yeah, we need to have dialogue about race. Yeah, we need to talk about race, because they think that they're just going to be able to come. And, you know, I was in a sexual relationship with a black person and I went to an integrated school and the black people were black supremacists and, you know, targeted me and bullied me and harassed me on a daily basis. And, you know, I've done all this fantastic stuff and I do diversity and white privilege and all that. And, you know, the non-white person will just be pacified and not think of them as a racist. As I said, that is the expected way that these dialogues go, and that should be changing. Like, you don't have to call them cracker and honky and do a lot of name-calling and cursing. Dr. Francis Cress Welsing, you can be as cool, as confident, as calm as you please. And that is the goal, that is the standard that we strive to achieve on the context of white supremacy to be professional, candid, courteous, and just asking questions, following the logic to parse through whatever it is they're saying, interrogate what they're saying, and see if they're just giving us some racist nonsense, and try to get some constructive value from studying the way that white people use words, the way that they speak and talk about racism that generally confounds our understanding and ability to solve this problem. She was, in my view, I suspect, practicing white supremacy in so many different ways. Any white person that comes, I didn't know that her partner who had recently passed away was a black person because they didn't include that tidbit in the article. I wish that had been submitted, but I'm glad that that was included early on. Any white person who is sexually engaged with a black person, oh man, the suspicion should skyrocket. In terms of interrogating this person's behavior, their motives, just everything about them. This is maximum racist aggression. Having the white folks that are willing to hop in bed or the back seat or roll in the hay, as they say, with non-white people, maximum racist terrorism. That's the way that that should be thought of. And I mean, I won't even say what was going to pop in my head, but that is hugely important, and I'm glad that she shared that. And in my view, just because the way the article is written, she kind of ends the piece where she talks about having this quote-unquote interracial relationship while she was in high school here in Seattle. And I think the sentence that is in the article specifically, it says that these type of relationships, the importance of relationships across racial lines, that's the exact phrasing, that's important, that points the way to a future of hope. We're going to make some progress on this. And we talked about this last week. If you see the parallels, I think it was Kristen Green. She was on the program a week ago today. Same thing in a sexual relationship married to a non-white person. And the same thing where they're talking about the Loving case in Virginia and the statistics on increasing numbers of non-white people who are in some sort of sexual arrangement, tragic arrangement with a white person. And that's supposed to represent progress, hope, the defeat of racism. That is total that is racism of the highest order. If that was the case, this conversation would have never taken place. This would have ended with Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. If you need to put it in 21st century terms, certainly we do not think of Donald Sterling as being, you know, a crusader for justice and anti-racism. At any rate, I would encourage listeners, I started thinking about this before we did the program today, David Shields, he's a white person. He was on the program, I believe, the end of 2013. He's also a professor at the University of Washington. He was on the program. Stephen Bezruchka, he was a white male. He's a professor at the University of Washington. He was on the program at the end of 2009. If you check 2010, we had an entire class of white people. We didn't get every single white person who was in the class, but it was quite a few of them, white people that were on the program. They were taking a course at the University of Washington. I think it would be very informative to pool all of those programs. I'll see if I can go back and nab all of the different programs that we've done. I think there was a white woman. You have to give me a second to get her name, but they're anti-racist coalition here in Seattle. This is one of our first like 20 programs that we did. This is like the summer of 2009. That one, I'll try and cull all of the programs where we have had white people who are in Seattle on the program. I am of the opinion the white people that are here in Seattle, it is a refinement unlike anything that I've seen anywhere on the planet. I've lived on the East Coast. I've lived in Virginia. I've been to New York repeatedly, in Washington, D.C. I've been to Philadelphia. I've been to Chicago repeatedly. I've been to Texas. I've been to New Orleans. I lived in California. I lived in Georgia. I've traveled extensively in the U.S., and I've been here. I didn't grow up here, but I've been here now for several years. It is unparalleled. The conduct, the refinement of white people in this area. And I don't know what it is. I haven't reached a point where I can state causality. I do think that some of it is that there are not that many black people here, which I think drastically shifts the way that racism, white supremacy operates when it's a very low number of black people in a given area. And historically, there have not been very many black people in this area. I think that has a big impact on the way that white people function and adjustments that they make to how the system operates and even some of the refinement that they display. It is incredible. The evidence I would submit is just listen to the programs where we've had white people that have been on this program who are in CI. And it doesn't matter. Age is irrelevant. We've had white people that were in their teens and early 20s, all the way up to Dorothy Bullitt, who's in her 60s on the program. If you just kind of put all that together and listen, I think you will see some amazing trends out of the people in this particular area. That notwithstanding, if folks have comments, observations they would like to share, feel free. My mind is still racing, even going over some of the things that she shared. I'll try it so that I'm not stepping on observations that people have, so you can get your comments and anything else that stood out that you were listening during the exchange. But it was so much. It was so many different times, in my view, where she's blatantly, deliberately practicing white supremacy from the beginning of the program to the very end. I guess if I had to pick one thing, I'll take that one. Black supremacy, to have a white person, suspected race soldier, comfortably, consistently using the term black supremacy, to say that she experienced racism, black racists, for a major chunk of her life, to say that with so much confidence, with so much assertiveness, and to immediately recoil at the term white supremacy and to state bluntly, I'm more comfortable with the term white privilege. If anything, I think this week I spent a lot of time on Facebook and Twitter pointing out the massive incorrectness of the term white privilege. That's 2 weeks in a row where we had white women on the program who were sexually involved with black people saying they prefer white privilege. Kristen Green said the same thing when I did my definition. She said that my definition of racism is much softer than yours. I generally use the term white privilege to talk about this. And I have insisted when you have Macklemore, the admitted racist known as Timothy Wise, Dr. Peggy McIntosh, the list goes on, and all of these white people parading out and insisting white privilege, white privilege, white privilege. That is a colossal act of white supremacy. This is not unconscious. This is deliberate white terrorism, and not using correct words to describe this problem. They know, because of our confusion, because of our victimization, we will go with the terms that they use. Those terms contaminate our brain computer. They contaminate our understanding of what it means to be white, what racism is, how it works. You want to use what is the problem? It is the beginning of knowledge to call things by their proper name. White people know they are waging war against black people, especially non-white people in total, but especially black people. They know this. They don't want to call it that. Let's call it anything but that, so that we can just continue to pillage, plunder, rape them forever and keep them totally confused about what is happening. It should be rejected every time, not sometime, every time. That's why I insist, do not ever use that term on this program. I try to be kind about it. I try not to fuss at anybody about it when it pops up, because it came up last weekend on the compensatory call-in, and I try not to interrupt immediately when people use the terms. What are you doing, you coon? What are you doing? That's not the way to handle it, but it is extremely important. If you get nothing else from this program, words are hugely important. I am still learning, and I'm still trying to use and figure out the best words and definitions myself, but that is one I have come to an unequivocal conclusion about. This is not white privilege, and I'm not in the business of using words that appease and make racists comfortable. If anything, we should be making racists uncomfortable and disrupting their business of white terrorism. And I will wrap there. If you have observations, thoughts you would like to share, the number to dial is 641-715-3653. 40. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That was pretty tacky too. The profanity. That's another reason why I say it's G-rated. The cows is G-rated. Let them do all of the cursing. Make sure that it's very clear who the tacky folks are. It is white people. No cursing. I don't need to curse to talk about racism, white supremacy. I can be as clear and accurate, razor sharp in describing this problem, and I don't need to use a single profanity. As profane as what white folks do to us is, I don't need to use a single one. Let them come on and be uncouth and tacky and get mad and start going, let them do that as calm and cool as you please. This is what it is. If you don't agree, that's fine. When she kept saying putting words in her mouth, that's important too, but I'll hush there. I'll take a quick commercial just so that I can get a little water and snicker a bit at some of the things that took place, and then we'll just go right to the phone lines. If you could watch the background noise, that would be grand. There are a lot of people who called in with, observations, so I will probably just open everybody's line up because I just don't feel like going through to parse out every caller, so I'll open up everybody's line. So if you could watch the background noise, that would be grand. I will, you know, make sure everybody has time to get whatever comments that they would like to share about what they heard. Fascinating. I cannot say that enough. Fascinating exchange from Dorothy Bullitt. I'm super glad that she came on the program, and I will make that promise to folks. I don't hardly ever make promises, but if she does, if she contacts me and lets me know that she's doing any speaking engagement here in Seattle, or if it's in Western, my part of the state, Western Washington, I will hook, crook, barter, steal. I will get myself there and we will get it recorded. I will make that a guarantee. I'll try to bring other non-white people. I don't know if we can do it live because sometimes that can be difficult depending on internet access and all that, but I will make a guarantee. If she lets me know and I find out about it in advance, I will do everything in my power to make sure that I am there so that I can ask a question or five and to try to bring other codified non-white people with me, because I think I know other victims who would be excited at the opportunity to go and question such a white person. So I will make that guarantee to folks, and we'll see if that happens. If anything, as I've said consistently, reading the newspaper, because this program, the only reason it happened, reading the newspaper. I said earlier this week that I need to do a much better job of reading my local paper. I check the Washington Times way more than I check the Seattle Times, and I live right here. They're talking about stuff that's on my block sometimes, and they talk about racism all the time. So I will do a much better job of checking the Seattle Times, but that's the only reason that this program happened. Dr. Welsing would definitely be proud. She encouraged that all the time. Be checking the news locally, nationally, globally. They're talking about white supremacy all the time. Check the news. That's more important than watching Empire, How to Get Away with Murder, Scandal. Get a newspaper or turn the news on. Listen to it if you're in your car, what have you. Check out the news. It's super important. A quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Context of white supremacy.
RacismDaily.com, your number one source for global news reports on race, racism, and overt actions of white supremacy. From Asia to the Americas to Europe to Australia to Africa, racism is not a thing of the past. It is our current reality. Be informed. Be globally informed. You should be the first to know. RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com, RacismDaily.com.
Is racism hurting you? On issues of race, are you unable to speak, think, and act with clarity and confidence? Are you tired of laughing when nothing is funny, smiling when you are not happy, agreeing when you really disagree? CounterRacism.com, you can learn specific strategies and techniques to counter the behaviors of the people who practice racism in all areas of activity. Using words correctly, following counter-racist logic, even counter-racist science projects designed to reveal what racism is, how it works, and how to counter it. The open source code writing format allows you to pick and choose from a variety of counter-racist suggestions so you can produce the code that works for you. Stop by counterracism.com today and help replace racism with justice.
That's counter-racism.com.
Do you need a one-stop shop for all of your multimedia needs? Triumphant Multimedia is a skilled team of professionals with a passion for great marketing and chic design. Our specialties include consulting, brand development, copywriting, and creative graphic design. That's second to none. We also offer photography, photo retouching, videography, and video editing. At Triumphant Multimedia, our goal is to provide highly effective creative solutions built to suit any individual need or budget. Give us a call at 678-732-8067 or check us out online at TRIMultimedia.com.
Right on. And just for folks, maybe I'm trying to short circuit some of the emails and some of the work that I have to do so I can focus on other things. You can nab the book, My Life at Oxmoor, Life on a Farm in Kentucky Before the War, by her great-great-grandfather. I can't even say suspected if you're on literal plantation. White terrorist Thomas W. Bullitt. If you just put in My Life at Oxmoor, it should pop up if you do like a search, My Life at Oxmoor. I guess if you really want to nail it, you could do My Life at Oxmoor archive.org. If you search it that way, it should be the first hit. And I think even if you just do My Life at Oxmoor, it should be the first hit. But you can download it, PDF, Kindle, EPUB, whatever. They got a ton of different format. Or you can just read it online if you don't want to download it. You can just do it that way. But it is a hoot. There were some other juicy tidbits that I didn't even read, but it is fascinating. If you want to do some research, and shout out a listener who tipped me off and let me know that that book was in existence and might be something to read. I will submit that I think she might be lying. I think that was the case for many things, but I do not believe that she didn't read that book. In fact, I said this was before we went live. I told her, because she asked me about how long I thought the program would take, and based on the questions I had, I thought that I could probably knock everything I had out in about 60 minutes. And I told her, I said I had a few snippets from the book that I wanted to read, and she said, oh, you're probably more informed about that than I am. And that, for me, is a major alert. I just don't believe, I don't care what we're talking about, I'd never take the position that I am more informed than any white person about any aspect of racism, white supremacy. I never take that position. He says at the very beginning of the book that this book was written for my family. This book was written for Dorothy Bullitt. To check this out, it was not written for me. It wasn't written for the public. It just eventually did get published for public consumption. But I do not believe that. I strongly suspect that she has read this book, whether it was in her house or she read it later on or whatever the case may be. I do not believe that for 3 milliseconds. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Again, if you could watch the background noise, no speakerphone, and if you could be, you know, you could say whatever you want, but just be mindful that there are quite a few hands up to just make sure everybody gets an opportunity to get their thoughts in. Everyone who dialed in with a hand up should be with us. Feel free to chime in.
Greetings.
Can I be heard? Greetings.
Greetings.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay. Yes. My participation tonight would be from this standpoint. From 1968 to 1975, which is the year that I graduated, May of 1975, that I graduated from high school, I went to school with white people just like her. Correct from wrong, Gus, she said she was 60 years old. I am 59 years old. I was born in 1957. And she is exactly her attitude, her behavior, her experiences, her way of twisting, manipulating experiences to fit the mold that is suited and fitted for a white person who in a refined way would want to practice racial white supremacy. just like her, the people white people I went to school with, and Dade, down here in Miami-Dade County, during those years, in and around those years, is when they, from a massive level, put white children and non-white black children in the same schools together on a massive level. It's not the, what I'm saying, it wasn't the beginning of quote-unquote integration, but on a massive level when they started it in and around the late 1960s, and in my case it was 1968. And the things that she was saying actually were reactions. I heard you say it during the interview, were reactions to racism that the black young people were involved in. Primarily from an emotional standpoint. The code for militant actually to me is reacting, a non-white black person reacting in an emotional way. It may be violent in some sort of way, but also in an emotional way as far as reactionary, as far as speaking, whatever, that sort of thing. And she twisted all of that. She, in a very fine way, she has the ability to twist that into stating it's black supremacy. And I don't take it from she's doing it from a standpoint of ignorance. She's doing it from a standpoint that, for the most part, she doesn't get any pushback on that. For the most part, when she's saying that to non-white black people, she doesn't get any pushback on that at all. Because, in my opinion, we are the ones who are confused collectively on the system of racist white supremacy. And we don't have an understanding that when a white person is stating that they are actually practicing racism and white supremacy in a refined way. So that's how familiar it was. That's how interesting the program was, because I'm just listening to this white woman doing her discourse through the whole process that you were interviewing her, and when she was talking about her experiences. The whole idea about the sexual relationship between her and the non-white black male, as I heard Mr. Fuller state, is that it is the white person who commands that relationship. In other words, she was eyeballing him. She may have been eyeballing him, but she said, "I am not going to involve with that nigga until he gets rid of that militancy." She said that in the interview, from my understanding, correct? If I'm wrong on that, you know, as far as they're concerned, she set the tables on when she was going to engage with this non-white black person, as far as they're concerned. And so it's quite interesting on how I was picking it up based on putting my mind back to the late 1960s, early to mid 1970s. Because, like I said before, I went to from sixth grade, which at that time was called junior high school, to the year I graduated from high school. I went to school with a lot of white people just like that. They have these class reunions that I don't ever go to none of them, you know, as far as that's concerned. And because I have no interest in socializing with white people in general, especially that experience. It was a very negative experience as far as I'm concerned. The whole idea as a white person where she had the nerve to say about, I made the sacrifices. I could have went somewhere else, but I made the sacrifices to be able to stay there because I know by staying there, if I didn't stay there, if all of us white kids, in other words, she wasn't by herself. And the same thing it was back during the time when I was in high school, they were all concerned with one another. If we stay there, then this will keep alive. This will keep this type of effort alive. We stay hung in there. And she uses that. She uses that as a badge of, in my opinion, a badge of racism, white supremacy, or refined racism, to be able to say to anybody, especially another black, a black person, that, hey, I deserve to be off the list of being a racist because I hung in there when black people were were saying nasty things to me and hung in there and did the right thing and stayed around and that sort of thing. You know, I mean, very interesting, very interesting. It definitely goes into my counter-racist files as far as the refined means and ways of white people. And I will conclude that it also indicates to me continuously that the most refined version of white people who practice racism are white women. I mean that was, she was a slickster, you know, as far as that concerned. She was very silky and slick on how she is able to go to a level of ignorance, I don't know, I'm not an expert in this, to being so vivid in her mind on memories of how black people have practiced racism against her, you know. And so that's all I have to say, but thank you for listening.
Right on. Tapelo, did you want to comment?
Greetings, everyone. I was fighting to get in because it was busy the whole time until, you know, a little few minutes. But I went online and listened to it that way, a little bit of it. But from what I heard from her, she was definitely practicing racism and was ready to get up out of there as soon as those questions started getting real hard. What really caught my mind is how she compared, how do we put it? She compared the behavior to sibling behavior, the favored and the not favored, right?
Yes, sir.
How white people would be the favored child compared to the not favored child. And I'm saying to myself, well, you're saying that the favored child doesn't know? They don't know how it got that way? And you're living in Seattle. And I got that message late about when I got the message, it seemed like it was today where you send the questions in, and I think I got my question to you a little late though, but I wanted to ask her what was she thinking on what was white people saying when they were running the I-5 through the black neighborhood and displaced the black people. You know, what was she doing and what was white people thinking and what saying about that issue when they were pushing that eminent domain through there? And that would have been a great question to ask her if that hasn't been asked by anybody or if she didn't talk about it. But I'm definitely got to listen to it the rest of the time. But I think she was lying about being attacked. It just didn't make no sense. She was talking about grade school. And so why would 40 people attack you? And I was like, 40 black people? And what school was this? You know, I mean, in Seattle? I just don't see that many black kids in any of those schools now. But maybe they were packing back then. I didn't see it when I was living out there. And I go out there to visit, I don't see that many black people in any school. So I'd be surprised, I guess. I could be wrong. But I don't think she was being honest about that at all. I think she was just trying to make up something so that she could be a victim. But that's all I'm going to add on that, because she was just practicing her thing, man. She was really good at it. I'll mute myself.
Right on. Other folks who had a hand up that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, just a few things. I think she was definitely
definitely practicing white supremacy. I don't think it's an and, if, or but. It's clear. And the first thing, one of the first things, it's very clear that one of the many majillion examples that white people are not ignorant about racism. I think why she didn't take callers is it precisely because she listened to the show. That's why I think that was a strategic move on her part, and I strongly suspect that she just lied, because I like with the other callers, I think she was lying all over, and I think she lied when you asked her, you know, to see her in another engagement. I think she lied because she knows what's coming, so she's definitely not stupid. And the way she talked about reparations, this reminds me a lot of how Martin Luther King talked about white liberals. They always want to say, wait for this, wait for that. Anything to delay making a real impactful change. I think she was a classic example of that. And another brief point, she's totally wrong about Canada. I just wanted to point that out. Slavery, for folks who don't know, even some people in Canada don't know, enslavement did exist in Canada. And one of the things that was really strategic I find about her is when she kept saying, when you're asking her hard, or I'm not even going to say hard, substantive, important questions. Oh, I'm tired. Oh, I'm exhausted. That is a white supremacist, racist woman technique of the innocent, docile white woman being terrorized by a black male. That's exactly what she's playing on. I know she's doing that on purpose. And I think she's lying about the physical abuse. You know why I think she's lying? I think the verbal stuff, she may have told the truth, but might be withholding the fact. Like, she looks like the type that probably started the racism. But why I think the physical is definitively a lie, she never gave a specific detail. When white people talk about racism or actions they receive from black people and they're telling some form of truth, I'll use truth very loosely here, they're usually very detailed. Like when you had Mr. Grimsley, I think it was, you had a couple weeks ago, he was very detailed when he talked about certain things, and if he didn't want to talk about it, he just said it, but she was definitely lying. And another thing, with her being with that black man, I think she is an emotional manipulator when it comes to non-white people, and I think that's exactly what she did with a confused, vulnerable black male. That is exactly what happened. And that's why these interracial relationships with whites, for black people, specifically black people, especially, I think, in my opinion, I can't prove this, black males, it is a fundamentally tragic arrangement. I think that is the perfect word you use. I was listening to your past podcast, your past discussions, and I love that word for these relationships. And the last thing I want to end off, the fact that she wanted to stay in this school, I just kept thinking about Dr. Annie, about, you know, the European is silly, to control. I think she stayed there because she wanted to control these black people. She wanted to show she could control the environment. That's why I think integration, physical integration in workplace, school, any important area of public activity and communication, integration with whites is nothing but benefit for them to exercise their power-hungry, lusting tendencies. That's why integration wholesale is bad for black people. It benefits whites, and she's a prime example of this. And I'm done, and I'll mute my line. Sorry if I talk too rambly. I hope I was clear.
No apologies needed, sir. Anyone who hasn't spoken, feel free to jump in. I just wanted to get in. Also, she said she inherited her black in-law. Just that term to me sounds exactly like what her terrorist white enslaving ancestors would have said. I inherited this black person. Anybody that we have not heard from have comments?
Can I be heard? Can I be
heard? Let's get our female caller in Ohio first.
Thank you. I'll be real quick. Thank you to the gentleman. Hello to you, Gus, and to all the callers and listeners. I listened. Well, I came in on this. I guess I got maybe about 45 minutes of it. And I know, like you say, respective racism. I'm just like the woman is just racist. But, you know, I get that, you know, suspected. But this is what got me, and the gentleman that right before me spoke about it, where he said Martin Luther King said about, like, white liberals, you know, and how, you know, remember he wrote this letter to a Birmingham, you know, letter from a Birmingham jail, and he basically was taking on those preachers who were just, like, saying, oh, just give it time, you know, things will work itself out. Well, when you asked her about the reparations, and it struck me because the answer she gave is basically the same answer that Bernie Sanders gave when he asked about these reparations. And he said the same thing. He said, no. He talked about how, oh, it would just be so divisive. Didn't she say that? And he said what he would like to see is a study so that he can look in places of investment. And so when she was saying that, you know, she was just like, you know, investments and education and all that, you know, and I sort of listened to it. I'm like, well, you know, I'm almost 60 years old. I'm like, I ain't going to school no more. So, you know, just give me my money. I can do with my money what I want. But it just bothers me when I hear that. And the other thing that gets me too, because I kept saying, I said, just ask her, what does that look like? You know, when you say investments, you know, when we're looking to investments, and she says something about crime-free neighborhoods, something like that. Those weren't the exact words, but something to that effect. You know, something about free education. I'm just like, well, you know, public school is a sense of free education, and you're not doing that right. And I'm just like, what does that look like? So, you know, like the gentleman said, like Martin Luther King said, I remember Shirley Chisholm said it too, and like Shirley Chisholm said, you know, about white liberals being like worse for black people. And, you know, when I heard that, I mean, that just struck out. But then, when you asked her about reparations for Jewish people in Japan, and she's a 60-year-old woman. She has the same age. And she says, oh, I don't know anything about that. I was like, come on, that you are lying. That's just a straight out and out lie. You know, and so it is something about how, you know, when it comes to stuff for blacks, you know, it's just always pit dragging. You know, she pretty much said it too. Oh, it would just be very divisive. You know, and I always, it kills me because I'm just like, and I guess we're so together now, you know. So that just really jumped at me. The other thing that got me too was, you know, she's talking about being in the sexual attack. And you asked her, you said, what sexual attack? Oh, somebody grabbing my couch, grabbing my desk, something about in the bathroom, guys, attacking her, something like that. And I'm just like, and you didn't say nothing. I mean, let's face it, a white female can say, any black man did something to her sexually, and that guy is gone. You know, the time in history, that person was lynched. No questions asked, no evidence presented. She just said it. So I'm just like, I'm not buying that. And I think the other thing that really stuck out at me, too, is that when everybody was leaving the school and, you know, she and her other white friends, they just sat there, you know, the great white people to help the school so that the school would be good. It just would be so bad. And, you know, we'd be white people here, maybe it'll be integrated. So that really struck me. And then you asked her something, I think she said something like, oh, I was like 12 years old. I'm just like, what 12-year-old person say like that? But, you know, so I don't know. My biggest, life has shaken me out of the thing. Grown woman, you know, out of college, and into to the workforce, and I never could put my finger in the The major problems I always had was with white women. And now this thing is just becoming very clear to me as to why. So I just want to say thank you for the show, and I'll mute myself.
Right on. The caller listed, I guess, as victim. I don't know if you're on the vote line or how you dialed in, but were you going to comment as well, sir?
Yes, I did. I wanted to say thanks for taking my call. I wanted to say I totally agree with the caller from Canada. You know, you have this suspected racist woman that chooses to stay at a, you know, mostly, you know, black school. Basically, they want to practice white supremacy. They want to study black people hands-on. They don't want to do it from a distance or from TV or by hearsay or from what's passed down to by their parents and family and friends or whatever. She wants to study black, study the niggers, you know, hands-on, up close and in person, and she wants to feel supreme. So if I surround myself by people that are, you know, less than me or deemed less than me, then I can feel supreme. So that's why you chose to stay at a school, not for some type of doing some type of favor to black people or whatever to the school. Also, I think that when these people, these white people, that they start exploring and try and start figuring out that, oh, my family owned slaves, and you know, I'm a descendant of slave owners. The only reason they even start delving into that is really, it's kind of like a badge of honor, like some type of prestige for them to kind of proclaim to the world, to other white supremacists and to black people, that, hey, I come from a stock of, you know, some of the higher echelon white supremacists, you know. Just, it's kind of like a reminder. I think they use that to build like self-esteem, just to reaffirm that, hey, you know, just when they feel like, you know, they're not practicing white supremacy to the degree that they should, they can just kind of look back on their, you know, their ancestors and say, hey, look, hey, I come from this stock. This is me. You know, I should be practicing white supremacy at this level. And I just think it's a badge for people. And also, again, and with white people, when they claim ignorance, you know, I don't give white people the benefit of the doubt for nothing. Just like Nellie Fuller said, you know, they study a grain of sand, you know, in the bottom of the ocean. They will study anything. So typically what I found is when white people don't know something, they will fake, they will pretend like they know something, or they'll work their way through it somehow to pretend like they know something. Like even when I'm on a job and I'm directing people, you know, white people on how to do something or something that they don't know, that, oh, I kind of knew that. I was just trying to be sure that they will typically, they're going to work their way through something when they really don't know something. They'll talk their way through it somehow. And lastly, yeah, it's just like words, the importance of words. Again, just like, you know, when she used the profanity, she was like, you know, you're interrogating me. So, you know, interrogation, it's like, man, they are masters of words. And interrogation, you were just, you know, man, you were like a, you know, crooked police officer just badgering her and just, hey, what is this? So anyway, that's all I had to say. Thank you very much.
10th generation attorney. 10th generation attorney. Can't when we said Dr. Welsing is a third generation physician, 10th generation attorney. Thomas in New York. Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Thank you very much, Gus, for taking my call. Good evening, and good evening to all the callers. Very interesting show. She was very refined. She started off refined. You know, she didn't come to talk about racism, white supremacy. She came to talk about white privilege. So she set it off with that. The tragic arrangement, you know, that's an automatic racist bell, you know, in my eyes. She gave pushback on her family's history of rape, which I found, you know, to be typical. You know, her reparation, she didn't like your tone. She wanted to talk about Indians all of a sudden, you know, like, you know, well, how would the Indians feel? And she would not answer you when you asked her who would be upset. You know, that would make people upset. You know, he was like, well, who would be upset? She didn't want to answer that. The black supremacy. No, I haven't heard that oxymoron since the Tillman book, you know. She was very, no, that whole story was just, you know, so people called you names. And I do not believe that she was sexually assaulted. I mean, what white person is going to be sexually assaulted? People walking through the hallway and they're just squeezing her breast. Like, I mean, this is America. I don't know what. Unrealistic. Unrealistic altogether. I don't believe that at all. And, you know, these white women don't go and say anything to the authorities. You know, sounds Cosby-ish. And, you know, I just want to commend you because you did a great job, as always, you know, keeping her on the line. What I realize is when they want to leave and they do turn around and stay, it's usually to answer a question. They feel like, oh, this is when I could practice racism more. And, you know, she really wanted to go that last time. And you said, oh, well, I just want you to explain about this, how these black people practice racism against you. She's, oh, okay. You know, that was cool. She wanted to get that out, you know, I could get them on this one. And I think you gave great pushback the whole show. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Right. Other folks that we have not heard from, we have not heard from you yet, speak up. Don't be bashful.
Can I be heard?
Let's get our...
Oh, let the lady go first.
Right
on. Let the sister go first.
I'll be brief. Good evening, guests, and to the callers. Well, the guest, she was pretty nauseating to me. She definitely reminded me of Jane Elliott. I listened to the archives with Jane Elliott, and it was really interesting because someone inboxed me on Facebook this week asking me, they were a little confused about Jane Elliott. They saw a clip, and they were, you know, asking me about her. So I thought it was interesting that this woman really kind of reminded me of her. And she definitely, in my opinion, was practicing racism. Thank you, Gus, for asking the question to her, who is most confused. And she, like most of the guests, has said white people. But I think another caller had touched on how she, you know, was using the, she was kind of likening it to the favorite child. And I thought that was kind of hilarious because most favorite child or, you know, someone who's the favorite one, they know it. It's not like they're ignorant to that. So I thought that was interesting. I did have a question. She did she say that her parents sent her to a learning school? Is that what she was saying?
Was this, I guess, during the... Oh, yeah, I think she did. Yeah. I think she said this was like part of her, I guess you call it anti-racist education, I believe, during the 60s, during that period that, yeah, they sent her to get some sort of philosophy on what racism is. And Dr. King, yes, I think she did say that.
Okay. So I thought that was interesting, and I appreciated the firefighters, you know, just sharing that, you know, if anybody is not confused, she's not confused. She went to a learning school on how to really be refined in her mistreatment and practice of racism. I thought that was interesting. I also thought it was just another just clear sign of how she was practicing racism, like Jane Elliott, with her irritation. She was so irritated. She made it clear to you that she didn't want the, you know, questions from the audience. So I don't know what she was expecting from you, but she was clearly irritated and, you know, just, you know, trying to just play this victim role. So I just thought that she was definitely practicing racism. And the last thing I'll share is how, you know, she definitely wanted to stress that she was attacked or raped or whatever she was, whatever word she used, by black people or black boys when she was in school, but she ended up with a black person in her tragic arrangement. She inherited this black family. She didn't leave the school. So, yeah, I agree, like with everyone else, that was a lie, in my opinion, and she just continues to, just like the other white guests, in my opinion, prove that white people are not interested in stopping practicing racism. And I'll read my line. Thanks.
Don't have the energy. Final words. Don't have the energy. Ross, did you have a comment you wanted to share, sir?
Yes, thank you. This program was really something else. The firefighter in Florida really spoke volumes when he was talking about her being a white female. It's very funny, like you always talk about timing. Today I was listening to, and I'm still finishing, Dr. Welsing's 24th visit to the cows. And in that episode, she said something that I've said multiple times on this show, almost verbatim. She actually said that white women were the origin of white supremacy because they are the first people to raise both male and or bear both male and female children. And as a result, it makes sense that they would be the ones that are actually in complete control of the situation, even though it's presented to the world as if it's the white man that's running things. And I was just like, wow. And when the firefighter in Florida spoke about that, it just resonated on a deep level and took me right back to the episode because I was listening to it earlier today. And I also thought about when she said she wasn't taking any calls, that's a part of her refinement, simply because my research has led me to understand that racism, white supremacy is really all about domination and control, and that was her way of trying to take control of the program before even entering the program. And what I noticed was she had what I call the Tim Wise complex. I think she's so used to getting praise and accolades and worship by non-white people for whatever work she claims to do, that on this show, she slowly started to realize that that was not going to be the case, and she became much more belligerent as the conversation went on. I was surprised she actually stayed on as long as she did. I thought she was going to hang up way earlier. Something else that really tripped me out, too, was when she talked about how the black male who she was raping, how when she was dealing with his family members, that they had a lot of rage that they brought with them in the transition from the South to I guess, Seattle, where she lived and grew up. And I found that very fascinating because it reminded me of Henrietta Lacks and how like she broke those black people down to the point that now they basically consider her, I guess, a member of the family the way she's describing it. But you know, originally they understood who and what she was as a white person and treated her as such. And over time, she broke them down, just like the lady who wrote the book for Henrietta Lacks broke down her relatives to the point that they allowed her access to her medical records. So I found that very fascinating. And then it was interesting, too, she said at one point in the interview that white people during chattel slavery treated black people like pets. And then she magically inherited her so-called mother-in-law's mom. So she basically had her own black pet after, sadly, after the death of her her black boyfriend, I guess, because they never even got married. And then also, she spoke so proudly of getting her gene records back and finding out that her genes were pure European. And I guess in her mind, that made her think that her filthy terrorist ancestors did not rape or sexually assault any black people because of the fact that there was no genetic material of African people in her family tree. But I just say they just probably didn't impregnate anybody. I'm pretty sure that they had a free-for-all because that was just the way it was on the plantation. So I believe she was practicing racism with that as well. And I think that was it. Oh, yeah, the last thing. She also claimed that she was sincerely and greatly pained about racism. And I find that if she was truly a white person who really cared, she would not have been so ran to get off the phone when the questions started to get too intense for her. And that's my final observation. You know, she really claimed to be greatly pained, but she was pretty nasty to you. And also she wanted to get off the show quite quickly and found the rudest way to go about doing so. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Rebecca Skloot is the white woman who wrote Henrietta Lacks and, as you said, was able to break down the suspicions of the black family members and get all this information about victim of racism, Henrietta Lacks. But white woman, Rebecca Skloot. The other folks who dialed in, I guess we'll get our black female caller in New York. Did you have commentary, ma'am?
Yes, Gus. May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Good evening, Gus, and to the callers. Whew, wow. Okay, so I agree with you with regard to her knowing about great-great-granddaddy's book. I think that that might have been the first thing she discovered. And there's no way that she could not know about it and be flipping through the phone book to find all the black people with their last name, her and her sisters. And I think this whole, and her going through the scene, you know, her DNA, doing a whole DNA test on. I think that whole thing was to find out whether or not she had any black people in her family. I totally agree with the caller from Canada with regard to her, how she was treating the black male. Not only did she subdue him, she subdued his entire family. Because, if I'm not mistaken, she said that her the black male's sister was railing on her. And now she's all proud of that, you know, oh, that, you know, she's hugging me. Now we all have a kumbaya moment. So, yeah, this was all about her white power. She wanted to express how she had power not only over this man, but over after she tamed him, okay, her whole, his whole family. I also don't believe that all those things happened to her and that school. Even though she's supposed to have a good white family, I just can't see them tolerating their five-year-old or whatever, fifth grade or whatever it was, being being groped upon and all of this. And I just think that the whole story was a lie, and that her expressing the fact that I mean, that just really stood out for me about how, you know, her boyfriend was so militant, and he used to be this way and he used to be that way, and her calming him down and not wanting to be. I think that's a whole, that's that whole sick cycle sexual thing that white females have, and I just think that she came across like this whole Faye Dunaway thing. Taming the Beast. That was that's the only I just saw King Kong and Faye Dunaway. That's how I, you know, when she started talking about the black male, and that's all I had. I mute my line, but I totally agree with what everybody else said. She was definitely practicing racism. I mute myself.
Right on. Other folks we have not heard from. Anybody who had a hand up that we haven't heard from.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just found it interesting, again, like her fantasy stories about what happened to her at the school. I found it interesting that when she talked about the sexual assault, and a lot of white women tried to use a story of the black man being a savage, aggressive, sexually assaulting them, and a lot of white women tend to go to the word those stories as a way to like kind of justify their own racism. Another thing that I found interesting is when she was saying she was being attacked again at the school, you could tell right away that in her little story that she was trying to reinforce the image of the black savages not being able to control themselves, being militant, and she was basing her entire story on black representations that white supremacists often use. And I found that so interesting because if you could tell, all their stories are always the same. Every white supremacist, every white person is a white supremacist, and all of their stories are the same. So they tend to use the same story over and over again. It's like recycling the same story. So you can tell, and that's how I think we were, like all the callers were able to pick up the lies in her story because we've heard it so many times, and they've used the same story. And I think I found that so interesting. Again, and also about the white ignorance, white people being confused. They tend to use that justification in order to practice their racism, because if you look at history, you know what I mean? It's not like when she used the analogy of the big sister or the favorite sister or the favorite sibling. This is a story of brutality, colonialism, and genocide. So how do you not know what racism is? So if you look at the evidence, there's no way white people can be ignorant, because it's something that continues to happen every time. So it's just the same story, the same representations they consistently use. They recycle each other's bullshit all the time. But thank you.
For sure. G-rated, but for sure. Absolutely. Anybody who had a hand up, any comments, observations you wanted to make sure you got in, anyone that we have not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so there's a lot of things, but I started writing down on Microsoft Word when she said, I'm a realist about how politics works. And another way to say that is I'm a realist on how white people work. I'm a realist on how I work, the white women. And I think throughout the whole time she displayed this. I think when people talk about good white people, she should be the example. She's liberal, been with a black person, talked about privilege, but at the end has no interest in white people stop terrorizing black people And the project that she was going to run off to when she got off the phone, I don't think was going to was a project about eliminating white supremacy. The reparations questions, she quickly said, you know, no for black people, but she played ignorant for black people for the Jews. And how can she be informed for black people when she's not informed about reparations? And then just like the investment part is basically just another way to say, hey, if that were the case, black people ain't smart enough to handle money themselves or anything. So investment has to be made on their behalf. And then like your question on who would, you know, resist, those were really, that's a good question, because like the Jewish memorials that exist, who's resisting those? And that's an event that didn't even happen on this continent. Like the wording, like your wording about reparations, in particular for black people and non-white people. And it's just important because the way she was against it just implies how much white people want control, and all the wordings have to be on white people's terms. Militant, hey, if a black, the only time I hear that word is usually towards the black people, and if a black person can be militant, hey, we're going to need a word from Mars or something to have a word that describes what white people are. Black supremacy, quote unquote black supremacy, did not affect her in becoming a professor. In the school. I think the way she tries to portray herself is that she did a good job by staying in the school because she, I guess, knew what white supremacy was doing. And if she had a good intention, how can she ever say black supremacy exists, especially if she decided to stay? The favorite child thing, horrible example. You know, even somebody recognizing or not recognizing that they're the favorite child does not mean they have to, you know, terrorize the other children. And it's just a bad ranking system anyways. And then a Hitler scholarship, that to me would be interesting too. And then also in the beginning, 5% Neanderthal. That's something I never heard, but that's all I had to say.
Indeed. I also highlighted that as well. The Neanderthal, it reminded me of Iceman Inheritance, Michael Bradley. Anybody that we missed, if you are listening and you have commentary, you should not lollygag. Go ahead and get your hand up if you have an observation or a point that you wanted to make sure that you got in. A person they wrote in, they said, Professor Bullitt's statement about her maternal grandfathers were not rich but educated, while ignoring the fact that they had 100 slaves was significant. This corresponds to the fact that blacks were not human in her eyes. Secondly, when she spoke on her niece, the black female, or her niece who has a white parent and a black parent, she said she was a black female, that she's attractive. A number of times she said that she's well-traveled, educated, and funny. And she's the listener's interpreting this as she is a non-threat in the listener's opinion. She also felt like Professor Bullitt, she focused on the Eighth Area of People Activity, sexual intercourse, when she was talking about her niece. And lastly, she would not be surprised if Professor Bullitt is listening to the discussion now. That would not surprise me as well. I know many of our, as I said, it is a very different environment to be broadcasting and doing the program now, nearly 7 years in, as opposed to when we started. We came back on the air in 2009, even when we began initially in 07, when I don't think anybody, you know, knew about the program or Gus or anything like that, when we had total anonymity. However, I do not think that she heard anything more or knew anything more about this program other than the clip I sent her. I think if she did, she would not have come on the program. It would have been no surprise about the questions that came up and her irritation. There have been enough white people at this point, generally, if they know about us, they refuse flat out. From the it's no discussion, it's no negotiation. They're just not coming on the program, or they don't even respond to inquiries, at least in my view. The people that are a bit more informed or do some research, or they recalibrate, they will say that, yes, they're coming on the program, and then it's like, whoa, wait a minute, upon further review, I'm not going to do it, because the audio clip that I sent her, it didn't even have the name of the program in it. I didn't say anything about the cows or white supremacy, or even, I didn't even say Gus T. Renegade. I said Gus in the email. So I'm of the opinion that she probably did not know. She probably had not heard anything other than what I gave her, or she had not done any research, because she would not have come on the program, callers or no. I could be in error on that one. Is there anybody that we have not heard from? Anybody who had a hand up that we have not heard from? Cool. Get everybody. Everybody who had a hand up, we got everybody. Didn't miss anyone. Awesome. Awesome. If you have a comment, if you're listening in and you want to get a quick comment, you should get your hand up now. If you have anything you want to say before we wrap up. One other thing I will submit, I would probably have to go back and listen just so that I could jot down different things that stuck out during the course of the program. I thought it was profound when she said, I think this was when she gave her first curse word, and she was saying that she felt like I was indicting her as an enslaver, which you can go back and listen. I think I was just reading segments from the book and asking for her commentary, but I think you all already touched on the skill with which white people do the playing the victim, and I've seen this across the board. White people do this. I would say white females are especially dangerous and adept at pulling off the weeping, victimized, aggrieved white woman act. They are especially deadly in that endeavor, but I thought that was significant. And when she was talking about her high school experience of quote-unquote black supremacy, and she said that she was not beautiful, that beauty was being black, she didn't have an afro, and she wasn't attractive by the other black students that she was around, I found that fascinating, because I have heard that almost verbatim. Talk about great losses. Myself, back of the bus, we started the cows together. We did just kind of a spur of the moment recording. It was a white woman, also a University of Washington student, even though she's graduated now right here in Seattle, but this was 07 when we first started with the cows. This was not on the air. This was just random call, and we started recording. We were talking to her. She also went to Garfield High School, same exact school here in Seattle. But she went to Garfield. She, at the time, was like 20, we'll say. And she said that, and this school still is predominantly black, non-white, even though there has been massive, what they call gentrification. It's in the Central District, affectionately known as the Colored District, even though they have got massive racial dislocation, and you just have a huge invasion of whites in that area. So it's probably not going to look like that very much longer. But at any rate, she said she went there. This is like the mid, early 2000s. And she said that she was not thought of as attractive. Black guys were not trying to talk to her. They were all interested in black females. And she felt way less powerful as a white woman. She didn't feel as feminine. She didn't feel like, you know, she was going to get a boyfriend or anything like that. And that this radically changed when she went to college, University of Washington, where Professor Bullitt is a professor, that this changed. Black guys did begin to find her attractive, and she felt more powerful as a white woman, since she had that sexual power over them, and she felt like she could control black men. She specified she could control sexually, have sexual power over black males and black females. And she even stated that she went to some dance like seminar or workshop in North Carolina for like a week or several weeks over the summer. It was exclusively black females, and she said she felt she had the same sexual power over black females as well, and that she probably could have had some sort of anti-sexual arrangement if she so chose while she was doing that. But it was almost verbatim at the exact same school just 40 years later. She said the same thing, and I think it, for me at least, it speaks volume to us getting an understanding of the massive incorrectness of being sexually involved with whites, that is hugely important, and that white people catch that immediately. They know the value of being able to terrorize, confuse, and sexually exploit us, and that, oh my gosh, I'm missing out on a major opportunity to practice racism and totally confuse non-white people by doing this. Huge aspect of counter-racism, understanding the incorrectness, the logic of why we should not be doing that, and then just making sure we stick to that and say that on a consistent basis, that under the system of white supremacy, it is totally incorrect. It is a massive act of white terrorism to be in any sort of tragic arrangement, sexual exploitation, sexual involvement with whites, to just be consistent with that. Stick to that part of the code and understand the why. Make sure you get as many other non-white people to understand that. But that is huge, and it's been my experience that white people are not confused about that at all. It's the same type of response down the line when they are denied sexual access to whites. They understand that you're cutting off a major avenue for them to practice racism, including the production of offspring that likely will be non-white that they can even do more damage with.
Gus, I would like to add something to that, too. I think with her saying that these black males, you know, sexually assaulted her, I think that was just some one of her racist, sick, demented sexual fantasies, really. I think she was just kind of acting it out. And possibly she could have been attending that high school and, you know, really, you know, kind of throwing herself sexually at these black males and just kind of accommodating them, and now it turns into, you know, sexual assault, you know, however many years later. But that's what I think. But thanks.
For sure. That little segment as well, where she said the day after Dr. King's assassination, where she was attacked by 40 black people. Hilarious. I co-sign, I think, the folks who said that they think this is just a total racist fabrication. But I thought the kicker with that, where her saying at the end of it that this is resolved by her making an impromptu speech to these 40 black children, I guess, and that disperses them, that she's able to say whatever she said and calm the savage Negroes, and they went about her business at 12, no less, because that's what she said at 12 years of age. That is, wow, what a doozy from a suspected racist white woman. Anything else folks wanted to get in? If you, I think we got everyone with a hand up. Any other comments? Anybody wanted to make sure they got in before we conclude?
Yes, sir. Mr. Fuller mentions about master spies. And the individual who gets that award almost, I mean, it's not even close, it's white females. With the ability to influence all aspects of people, meaning male, female, children, and their ability to move in and out of any crevice of non-white black existence, with almost without impunity in most cases. This was we just heard tonight, a living, speaking example of this type of person. I encourage everyone to file it away. It's a good teaching model as well as learning model. As I mentioned before, I experienced it back when I was in junior high school and high school. That was my first actual contact that I ever had with white people. It was with white people my age in what they call the public school system, and she is exactly like these people in thought and in speech. You know, she is just very good, and she's very good at articulating her experiences from that standpoint. Although they are treacherous and incorrect, but nevertheless, she can articulate it pretty well. That's how come I was able to recognize it. as far as that concerned. And so it was a pretty good program from that aspect. The whole idea, I mean, first of all, the whole idea of having the nerve to come to you and state that she's not going to take any questions. You know, it was good on your part to be able to stomach that, and so you can still get the most out of that person. I'm sure that's the reason why you went on ahead and did it, because out of that you can get a lot out of that person by acquiescing to what their quote unquote demands were to get the most out of that white person. And it was accomplished, in my opinion, it was accomplished from that standpoint. And, you know, very, very interesting. I have tons of more I can say about it, but I'll end it because I know you want to get off the air. But thank you.
Right. Anybody else? Anything they want to make sure they get in?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say that if you took the book from her great-great-grandparent, her article, and this interview, you can make like a little box set and have like a study on racist white female cognitive dissonance or something like that. I mean, I thought the whole thing was fascinating. Those three things together. Just line them up, and, you know, prerequisite with the fact that she didn't want to take any questions, as the firefighter said. But it was all about what she talked about, one of the first things she said, which was, I'm not comfortable. You know, this was all about her comfort level. Even as a child, this was about her comfort level. In her sexual relation of her tragic arrangement, this was about her comfort level. With regard to his family, this was about her comfort level. With regard to your questions, it's about her comfort level, her power and her control. I'm telling you, this is like a serious study on racist white women and their cognitive dissonance, how they just disconnect and make everything the way they want it to be. That's all I have to say. I'll mute my line.
Isn't that narcissism as well? Dr. Welsing has a whole segment in the ISIS papers on that, but isn't that sort of behavior where the whole, said this last week, Kristen Green, her biography on the closing of the schools in Prince Edward County, where it switches away from this act of war, this act of terrorism, and denying black children education for a half a decade, it switches to me, and, you know, let's talk about me and my tragic arrangement with a non-white male, and what I think about all this and my experiences and the birthday parties I had for my children and people thinking of me as being a good white person. Isn't that a major act of white narcissism to constantly shift the focus back to themselves?
Yeah, it is. It's also, you know, what they call it, you know, they come up with clinical names for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Dr. Wilson would also concur. That would fall under something that they like to hide under, you know, so they can get medication for it. Something called bipolarism. That's what they call it clinically. But you're right. It is a personality dysfunction. You're right.
Wow. Folks have, I agree. It would be, when you say like making it like a box set, taking the article that Jerry Large did, Importance of Black Journalism, taking the article that Jerry Large did in the Seattle Times, the book that her great-great-grandfather wrote, and then what she her performance on the program today, putting all that together just so that folks can process and get what, I guess, what would you want them to take from it, if putting all that together?
Could I mention one more important thing that I think is important, Gus?
Yes, sir. I just I was going to get the female caller if she could respond to
that.
Oh, okay. Go ahead. Go
at you.
To get from it, okay. So she did this big investigation. Okay, what it is that everything that she thought she was, she found out, and she always knew that she wasn't. Okay, so now she's going through this whole thing. How do I make this right? How do I justify this? Okay, all right, I got all this information and everything. I got to come out and I got to say that, you know, I'm feeling bad about it and look how great my family was. But at the same time, I really, really want to have sex with black people. I mean, she's all over the place with it. But it also speaks to how, you know, she, her, like you said, making everything comfortable for her. She's uncomfortable with her own self, with her own existence, which is this is something that's pervasive with white people in general. This is why, you know, this is why this whole problem exists, is because they understand that they are the minority worldwide. They understand that. They know that. And they understand the things that they do, why they do the things that they do. But putting it together kind of adds it all up. You can kind of see where her, how she's functioning, how her brain is functioning, and how distorted and how disconnected she actually is, even though, you know, with her quote unquote, what she calls herself as privilege, she's managed to keep it all together. I mean, I really, when I heard about the book, I said, she knows about this book. And I think that book is where it all started, Gus. I really think that that's where it all started. I think once she found out, her and her family, once they found out about this book, that's when this whole thing began. But she knew about this book. There's no way she didn't know about it.
I agree. I thought that was important. Thank you for giving us a little bit of extra detail. Just, it seems like, even though they in the book it states that there was no raping, regardless of what you might have heard, there was a whole lot of tortured enslaved black people being raped. That didn't happen here at Oxmoor in Kentucky. That didn't go down here, even though we had over 100 enslaved black people. No. We didn't do any of that. Just the fact that apparently she is engaged in this sexual exploitation of black people and other people in her family, because she has a white sibling. If this is her niece, I would think that it's a sibling of hers who is also in some sort of tragic arrangement. It seems to be a bullet family trait to have a taste for dark oak, as they said in Monsters Ball. But firefighter, you were going to add?
Yes, I was going to add back to the master spy. This is from a historical perspective, Freedom Summer, the Freedom Riders, where these white people were like jumping on trains and buses to come down to the heart of blackness. Down in the quote unquote down south, and my experience is when I was in high school, these white females were highly sexually promiscuous as far as that concerned, and it's during a delicate time when young people are just coming to the nature of having some likeness, quote unquote, for the opposite sex. A very gentle time in our lives, and when all of a sudden these white females are put into this type of situation, who are very promiscuous as far as they're concerned, and I'm talking about not from a standpoint of being dumb, from a standpoint of being able to use it. To be able to use it to have effectiveness on the further confusing non-white black people, and I would highly suspect that she was she could write a book on that as far as from being an expert is concerned, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
For sure, we can get in. There's one other person who has something that they want to make sure they include before the program begins. Our female caller in New York. I will see if I can put something together. I guess it would be like either a blog post, or I guess it could be other formats, a video or whatever the case may be. But I'll see if I can put something together, kind of putting all of these together from the book and the article in the program today, to see if we can get something constructive from that. If you have something you want to add to it or whatever the case may be, we can work on that moving forward. But I definitely think there should be some additional produce from this, because it was a fascinating exchange, in my opinion. Was there somebody else who had something they wanted to make sure they got in before we conclude? Everyone is satisfied. That is cool in the gang too. Just anything else that stood out, folks want to make sure they get in. I will assume everyone is satisfied. We'll check just to make sure I don't have anything that I thought was important to make sure should be included. Her not wanting to indict her ancestors, even though I think she did say explicitly when we were walking through some of the things that are in the book and, you know, that just are endemic to enslavement against black people. She did not want to indict them as white terrorists, white torture. That's another reason why I say I don't think she did any research, because it's in the title for the program. Like, if she had searched it all and seen the title for this program, it says Dorothy Bullitt, white terrorist ancestors. I think that would have been clear enough to be like, whoa, 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 these Negroes are crazy. There's no way I'm going to talk to, or even talking to him, even not taking calls. But that's why I don't think she did enough research to be appropriately leery of coming to this environment to talk in the first place. I think her family, I mean, just the prominence, I was going to make time for that, but I mean, you got to prioritize her, like, mother, her family is like credited with bringing television to this area of the world, like Seattle. Like, they have like a broadcasting company. I mean, it is monumental, the amount of things that they have done, in my view, based on the foundation of terrorizing and abusing, enslaving black people, like, to come to this area of the world and to all the things that they've set up and established. And I think she even shared during the course of the program that there's a professorship at the University of Washington that her ancestors, her white, in my view, race soldier family members, established at that university. It is just mind boggling, to a degree. Anything else I wanted to make sure I got it. It would probably be a lot more. It would take some time just to go back and listen to it again for me to get other things that stood out. Even her saying that her family came here in the 20th century. Alexander Scott Bullitt, who is her grandfather, I believe him coming here, and her saying that he's so progressive and all the other key terms that they throw out to make you think that this white person is not a white supremacist. I can only emphasize the Democratic Party at that time. I mean, even now, but the Democratic Party at that time is not the way, I think, non-white people who are confused and do not understand that these are just two wings of white supremacy, Republican wing, Democratic ring, that is all connected to white supremacy. But the Democratic Party at that time was not the party that was associated with black people, even in a superficial manner. It was the party of Ben Tillman. It was the party of Woodrow Wilson, who screened Birth of a Nation at the White House and said, this is, you know, the most grand piece of cinema I've ever seen. That was the Democratic Party at that time, for like the open, unabashed, staunch, you know, to hell with Negroes, now, forever, always. That was the Democratic Party at that time. And as Ben Tillman, we read that, Ben Tillman, Reconstruction of White Supremacy, he came to Washington to speak and give his views on, you know, the dangers of Negroes, and you got to keep an eye on them. So that's another piece as well that I thought was significant. I think with that, I will wrap, as I said, well, try and synthesize some important aspects and see if we can kind of put it together with some of the tidbits from the book, as well as the article that you should check out as well. I am going to send the program to Jerry Lawrence, the black male who wrote the piece in the Seattle Times, and see if he has any comments, if he might be willing to come in and hang out with us. But I am going to do that today. As soon as I get the program uploaded, I will make it available for him, and we'll see if he might be down to come and chat with us. I don't want to mess his gig up with whites if he comes on the cows, but I would be very interested, even if he doesn't want to come talk to us, I'd be very interested if he has any feedback based on her display this evening. That said, we will be here tomorrow. A beautiful segue to The Half Has Never Been Told, because we ended right with Area 8 and sexual terrorism against black people, and how that was a huge force in motivating whites in the empire of enslaving black people and encouraging them to buy, enslave other black people, that, oh, somebody else that I can rape and, you know, do what I want, and raping children, the whole nine. That's exactly where we're picking up tomorrow. Same program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If anything, hugely important, Dr. Welsing would say again, the importance of reading is more important than watching television. I think Scandal and How to Get Away with Murder return to the air tonight. Reading is more important. The more that you know about what happened to our black family members who were enslaved and tortured by whites, I think you do a much better job of understanding what we're looking at right now, because it's the exact same thing. They just refine as they go, but it's the exact same power dynamic, and whites are doing a lot of the exact verbatim things that they were doing 200 years ago, 300 years ago. You know, it just continues. It just takes a more refined form, 21st century. But that's tomorrow. Obviously, we have the compensatory call-in on Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. If you get confused, you have questions, comments, suggestions, gripes, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. If you can't find something in the archives, let me know, and we'll try and clear that up for you. We are fundraising 2016. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. Listener-supported counter-racist radio. If you are not into PayPal, let me know. You'll see the PayPal button when you go to the blog. It's in the top right corner. Just drop that email and I can get you a physical mailing address if you would like to support the program that way. Huge thanks to all the people who have invested and supported us nearly 7 years and allowed us to remain on air. Hopefully the cows has been, continues to be worthy of your time and energy. That said, I will say once again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. We want to be clear, lucid, so we can make the best possible decisions to protect ourselves from the likes of Dorothy Bullitt, Daniel Holtzclaw. This is a long-running tradition of white supremacy to have us intoxicated, inebriated, so that we are out of our minds and easy victims of white terror. If you're going to be a driver, passenger, pedestrian, you do not want to be intoxicated. They are looking for melanated motorists to cause all types of problems for us, even taking your life, much less you being locked up or getting tickets and all this other nonsense. That's what all this is about. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers. Buckle up if you're going to be in the vehicle. And just recall, you never know when you're going to bump into Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, Dan Pantaleo. You never know when that's what's going to be the person that's pulling up with those lights flashing. Do everything you can to minimize that being a disruptive force, even the end of your life. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.